to make sure that we're picking everything up. I'll be making notes from time to time, and I'll just probably writing names down, and sometimes proper names if they're unusual, if you could spell them, would help the transcriber. And when we finish, and I'll take this back, then we'll have it transcribed and sent to you, and you will have final control over what appears in print. All right, I guess then we're ready to start. This is Jim Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry talking with Professor Leo Mandelkern on April 28, 1986, in Dr. Mandelkern's office at Florida State University. Dr. Mandelkern, you were born on February 23, 1922, in New York City. Can you tell me something about your father and mother, their names, occupations?
How much do you really want to go into the family business?
Historians are interested in that.
Father's name was Israel Mandelkern, and my mother's name was Gussie Crossbench. That's her maiden name. And they were immigrants. I'm a first generation, I guess. They immigrated to this country, I would guess, in early 1900s, 1910, thereabouts.
And what did your father do?
Father was in a jewelry business.
And where in New York City were you living?
They tell me I was born in the Bronx, but I recollect only living in Brooklyn. That's where I was brought up, and I went to public schools there and to Abraham Lincoln High School in Coney Island or Brighton Beach. It was a very famous public high school in those days.
Did you have any teachers that had influence on you?
Yeah, in high school, and unfortunately I can't remember their names. I can remember their faces. In those days, 1934, 38, when I went to high school. Am I coming through okay?
Oh, yes, yes.
It was a depression day, so we had a lot of people who were teaching high school who had PhDs in their disciplines, not in education. And so I remember three people really had strong academic influence on me. It was a physics teacher, a chemistry teacher, and a history teacher. And I'm sorry, I can't remember their names. It was a long time ago. They all were PhDs. They all were basically professional historians or chemists or physicists who wandered into high school teaching because it was pretty hard to make a living in anything. And there was actually high school teaching in those days was a very high-paying, relatively speaking, profession. Strange as it may seem. I actually went to Cornell as an undergraduate as a history major, although I've been interested in science, because Cornell was very strong in American history. And I had won what was in those days a New York State Region Scholarship to Cornell, which I think I may be off by a factor of two, but I recall it paid $400 a year, which covered the tuition.
Before we get to Cornell, is this where you got your first interest in science then?
Yeah, in high school. Through these teachers in high school, in the lab and in the lectures. They were very good. And also, we had advanced math. We had math up through the beginnings of calculus.
Okay. That was my next question. Math background as well.
And in those days, anyway, if you wanted to. In other words, in a big high school like that, there was a really diverse set of courses and curriculum that you could pursue, all the way from vocational training to things like calculus. And
what was it like growing up in New York City for you?
It was delightful in those days. You could ride. Everything was safe. If it's not safe, there was never any concerns of safety or the problems I understand people in New York have. And as a youngster in high school, even in higher grade schools, when I was 12, 13, one had no qualms about hopping in the subway, going to Manhattan, going to movies, the show, or whatever there was. It was just, all you needed to do is have a nickel. And so it was very delightful. There were all kinds of things. You had friends all over the city. And Brooklyn was very pleasant. And commuting on the subway was just part of life, and it was a very natural part of life, and there were no problems.
When did you make the decision to go to college?
Oh, I think, I don't never remember consciously making that decision. I think it was just sort of a, anybody who did well in high school could always go to the city colleges, which is actually, I had originally planned to go to Brooklyn College. And then the scholarship came through and I switched to Cornell. So I can't remember making a conscious decision to go to college. I think it was just a, it must have been made when I enrolled in the academic program in high school. You always had a choice, and I think anybody who was a halfway decent student in those days pretty much aimed to go to college, because there were the states, the city schools, which then were City College and Hunter College and Brooklyn College. If I recall correctly, Queens College was perhaps in its infancy, or maybe even on the drawing board, and they were really top-notch, were considered to be top-notch schools, at least undergraduate-wise.
The scholarship, the Regents Scholarship, was that specifically for Cornell?
Yeah, well, there were two scholarships. One was you could, as long as you went to college in New York State, and that was, I forgot, maybe $100 a year. And then there was a specific one for Cornell.
I see.
And they were based, again, I don't know what happens now, but in those days in high school, you took Regents exams at the end of each year, or the end of your senior year, in the basic subjects. And these were based solely on your scores, as if only those who were interested in the Cornell would indicate their interest in the Cornell, but anybody could be qualified for the Regents, which covered any college. And these were based solely on your scores in certain selected regions like English or math, whatever the combinations were. It was a very anonymous sort of thing, just a mathematical sort of formula.
Okay. And you had, well, you said you had three great teachers in physics, chemistry, and history. You selected history as being the area that you were going to concentrate in. Why that selection?
Oh, I don't know. When you're young, you know, 16 years old, it's hard to say now. It's just that I got very excited about all one could do with history and learning about particularly American history, and what one could learn from what had happened. This teacher I had me read all sorts of books, Charles Beard, I remember reading, and things like that. And so this, I felt as though you could learn from what you could learn from American history, you could apply to what was going on in the world at that time. And there was a very tumultuous world at that time.
Had you given any thought to a career choice
beyond that? Not really.
Well, I guess the next question is then, when you got to Cornell in 1938, how long did you remain a history major?
About one semester.
One semester?
I was at Cornell just before that New York ACS meeting we met, and I was reminiscing with some of my old friends there. And what happened is, I went to Cornell because I was just really to the history, because I was interested primarily in American history, but then you had to take other courses, chemistry. I think I took physics and beginning math, whatever they had to take there, and chemistry, particularly freshman chemistry, in fact, wasn't particularly exciting. I still had the back of my mind what I had learned in high school. But what happened in history, they took us unsuspecting, a group of unsuspecting freshmen who indicated they wanted to be history majors, and put us in a class. Well, if you want to be a history major, you have to start with ancient history. And put us in a class of ancient history, which was made up maybe a dozen freshmen and half a dozen seniors and maybe a half a dozen graduate students in chemistry in history. And I'm sure there was the greatest course in the world in ancient history, but hardly one for a 16-and-a-half-year-old to try and do. So this wiped me out, so to speak, as far as being a history major. It just turned me off completely. And as a chemistry, I had a very nice lab instructor whose name I don't remember, and so I had this interest, and I decided to see what would happen, and I switched over sort of the middle of the second semester, before the first year was over. I had made up my mind after the first semester. I'd passed that ancient history, but by the skin of my teeth, and I figured that was a way to, I was going to get very far in history if that's all I can do, and so I decided to switch to chemistry and give it a try. And then Cornell was very good in chemistry in those days, it turned out, and that was a very good experience.
Do you recall who you had for that first chemistry course?
That was a fellow named Jacob Papish. They told me at the time, a very famous inorganic chemist.
And what? Let's talk about your 4 years at Cornell then. What else did you take in terms of chemistry? What faculty did you have?
Cornell, as I say, I thought was a very good place, particularly also for an undergraduate. And again, they sort of had two tracks at those days. I have no idea what they have now. One for those who are going to be chemistry majors, and those who are taking chemistry as a those who would go on to graduate school to become some sort of professional chemist, and those who are chemistry majors for whatever other reasons, pre-med, biology, etc. And they had the unfortunately, I had started late, so I didn't get on the track for the first year when I had a very good introductory course. So there were people there. Simon Bauer was an instructor in what was called qualitative analysis, which I don't teach anymore, but I don't know if you're familiar with it, which, of course, we learned chemical equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And that course, the labs, that was a five-hour course with lab. That meant you went to three lectures and three-hour labs or something of that sort. It was really a very difficult regime, and that really made me a chemistry major, because that was very, the whole concept of equilibrium and going in the lab and doing your unknowns. Then the next year, I did quantitative analysis, which wasn't very exciting. And the next year, to catch up, I took both the what they call the long organic course and the long physical chemistry course, which meant 3 hours of lectures at each and three labs a week in each. What saved me, I guess the reason I could do that at Cornell in those days, they had labs on Saturday morning. So in organic, the lecturer was a very famous organic chemist, Jack Johnson, and the lab was run by a young instructor named W.T. Miller, who then stayed on to become a professor and a fairly famous fluorine chemist. The physical chemistry was taught, the lectures was taught by a professor, Lynn Hord, H-O-A-R-D, who was very quiet in demeanor, but was a very, and wasn't a very, was an exciting lecturer in terms of his speech, but whose lectures and the way he introduced you to physical chemistry made me decide to be a physical chemist, because it turned out he certainly presented it, or the book. There was a book called McDougall's Physical Chemistry. In those days, there weren't very many textbooks. It was a very logically written book, and the thermodynamics was very interesting. And having struggled through all that in my junior year, and having taken the math and the physics that you need, I was able to take actually graduate level courses in my senior year. And that was really nice. I took J.G. Kirkwood's thermodynamics, which was a whole year course. In those days, thermodynamics as a two-semester course. I took, I still was sort of feeling my way, so I took an advanced inorganic course, an advanced organic course, one term each, and I took Frank Long's kinetics course, which sort of indirectly introduced me to polymers as an undergraduate.
That was your first introduction. That was a question I had later.
That was an indirect question, because what happened, well, there were two things in that senior year. One was the Kirkwood's thermal course, which is another set of, which actually Oppenheim, when they went to Caltech, wrote the Kirkwood and Oppenheim book on. That was really a tremendous course. The only thing that was bad about it is the second term in December of that senior year was Pearl Harbor. And then he was, I'm sure, I didn't know the details, but was in and out of, so he had graduate students teaching the second term. But the first term was the important term, and he was, again, not a great, you know, in terms of dramatics, not a very good lecturer, but it was extraordinarily well organized. And in kinetics, it was a very well organized course. And what we had to do there is write a term paper. And I was fishing around. I sort of was interested in, he had given some lectures on free radicals. And I talked to Frank Long. He said, well, there's some of this, they make something called polymers by free radicals. There's some books in the library. Why don't you get hold of them and write a term paper? And there was a book called Mark and Raff called Polymerization, which I got and read vociferously and wrote a term paper. Don't ask me what I got on it, but that was my first introduction, at least, to what were polymers. And it was a very, you know, backward sort of introduction.
Did you do any research as an undergraduate?
Yeah, as an undergraduate, they had what was called senior research, and I did senior research with J.G. Kirkwood, who eventually turned out to be my undergraduate advisor. And he, this is strange as it may seem, he was doing some experimental work at that time, and what he did was turn you over to one of his graduate students, one of the more advanced ones, and I was turned over in the same lab. There was Jerry Oster. There were two of us. One was a fellow named Chris Spork. I have no idea what happened to him, and he worked with, he was assigned to Jerry Oster, and I was assigned to a fellow named Fitzhugh Boggs, who also eventually married Elizabeth Monroe, who is one of Kirkwood's graduate students. They were both very nice to me. I was sort of quite green between the years. And I did experimental work on trying to verify what was the Kirkwood-Westheimer theory, essentially the ionization of the second ionization of a dibasic acid. I remember it was terephthalic acid, and we had this great big Wheatstone bridge, and they bought the chemicals that we needed, and I made the measurements. So I don't know, really know ever. I don't think ever got published per se, but I think Boggs used what we found in further developing his thesis. But that was a very exciting time. A senior year, except for the fact that the war broke out, was a very exciting intellectual time as far as chemistry and science to me.
No, the war had. I guess you were halfway through your senior year when the war broke out.
The war broke out. Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941, which is right in the middle of my senior year.
What effect did that have at Cornell? Were you aware of anything that?
Well, again, it depends. It didn't have a tremendous effect during that year, except the practical effect that school was, instead of graduating in June, I think we graduated the end of April or early May. It didn't seem to have a tremendous effect at the moment on the student body, at least in my close circle of people. It clearly must have had some effect, a lot of effects on the faculty, which I, in my naivety, was not aware of, because they were in and out and rarely there, and you never knew who would be in the next class when you went to class, basically when the second semester started. Example, in the thermodynamics class, I think that Elizabeth Monroe taught most of the lectures, if I remember, Fitzhugh Boggs, once in a while Kirkwood would pop up, and they were obviously, you know, in retrospect, getting involved in a great deal more activities. That particular period, till graduation, didn't seem to have a tremendous effect.
Were there any other students, colleagues of yours, that you remember from those days?
You know, as I say, there were really two. And one was Chris Spork, who I don't really know. I know he went on and got his PhD with Kirkwood, stayed on during the war, and then went on to Harvard Medical School as a postdoc, and I sort of lost track of him there. And another was a chemistry major, was a fellow, a very good friend of mine named Richard Work, W-O-R-K, whose father was a professor of vegetable crops or in the Ag School at Cornell. And after a chemistry major, he switched to physics as for his PhD, another PhD in physics, and went to academia, and recently passed away. He was a professor at Arizona State in the physics department. And coincidentally, he was involved in some physical aspects of polymers, but that was a complete coincidence. There was no real, we met each other, everyone. But those are two people I recollect.
What were you contemplating as a career? Of course, with the war going on, that probably...
I was contemplating wanting to go to graduate school. My experience with Kirkwood indicated that this is what I wanted to do. And in those days, and there was, I guess, some confusion about the war, it wasn't so easy to get into graduate school. Although I had respectable grades, I wasn't a Phi Beta Kappa. Part of the problem was just catching up in this big jam-up that I had done, which I'm not regretful because I think I learned a lot. So that was my goal. In between trying to locate, I got caught in the draft, so to speak. And so I spent 4 years in 49 months or something like that in the armed forces, working my way up to a first lieutenant, I guess, from a private.
When were you drafted then? Right after graduation?
September, October. It was just a very short time.
What did you do in the interim? Did you know it was coming?
I was pretty sure I knew it was coming, so I didn't do very much.
You were actually in the service for 4 years. Where were you first stationed? What were your first experiences?
As I recognized that this was happening, I was trying to get myself into some program, and one that looked appealing to me was the meteorology program. So I had made applications for this, but while these were pending, and I guess we worried about paperwork and bureaucracy, I got drafted, and living in New York City, I got shipped to what was called Camp Upton, which has a certain amount of history. That's where in World War I, Irving Berlin wrote some of his famous tombs about, and which later became Brookhaven National Laboratory. The fact is, so many years later, I was at a symposium there, and not being invited speaker, our quarters were in the barracks. And what they did there, you hung around for 3, 4, 5 days and did nothing really, and every morning they'd have a list and you'd line up. And one morning I lined up, they had my name on the list, and I lined up with my whatever we had in the bag, and they stuck us on a train and wound up in Miami Beach. And that's where I did my basic training. And in fact, I did my basic training there 3 times in succession because, at least 3 times, because I had this meteorology application pending. They weren't allowed to, somehow the paperwork got caught up, and they weren't allowed to move me until something. So one day, and I went over this, went through this, it wasn't very hard duty to take, incidentally. I went over this routine at least two or three times. And then one day they called me and said, you're going to the University of North Carolina, the meteorology program. I said, well, they don't have a meteorology program there. It was in Chapel Hill. I said, well, here's your orders. Go ahead. And so I went, and I wound up there. And I was the only one that got there. And yeah, they were setting up a program, but nobody from the Army. This was going to be a pre-meteorology program, but nobody from the Army had arrived yet. So for about a week, they put me up in the Carolina Inn. But then it sort of developed, and we stayed in the dorm there. And this was a pre-meteorology program, which was sort of dull, and it was the usual Army type of snafu. Most of the people there had all the calculus and the physics and the kind of courses that they wanted us to have. And eventually we got transferred to the regular meteorology program. I was assigned to the University of Chicago. And there I spent, 6 months going through rather rigorous both academic and a lot of physical to become a meteorologist.
While you were at both of those institutions, did you have any chance to visit the chemistry department? And
A little bit at North Carolina. Nothing, you didn't have much time to do anything in Chicago. But more than that, mostly actually, it turns out I had somebody knew from way back was a graduate student in physics, a civilian graduate student, so I spent a little bit more time in physics, but I did a little bit in chemistry, at least knew there were people around what kinds of things they were doing. But in Chicago, there wasn't really much time to do. They had us going from 6 in the morning till about 8 at night. In fact, and we were sort of kept isolated.
And where did you go after there? After Chicago?
Oh, I guess I got assigned as a meteorologist at Texas, and then Norfolk, Virginia. And then they put me out and sent me to training to learn about how to operate equipment, meteorological equipment, and see, the meteorology function of the Army, there was no separate Air Force. The meteorology function, the part of the function, the equipment part was given to the Signal Corps. It was Army. So I was sent to the Signal Corps labs in New Jersey, and we had a short 5 or 6 week course where we learned a little bit about how to handle equipment, and I was sent to the South Pacific just about the time of the Philippine invasion. And my job there, I think, was called the 5th Air Force. I forgot what weather squadron it was. It was the 5th. I've forgotten the numbers. You shouldn't put them down. But anyway, my job was then to keep the equipment, the meteorological equipment, in that theater more or less functioning, which was not a trivial job in those days because we had a great deal of problems with the high humidity, and we didn't have the technology to keep things dry and that we have now. So it was. And I spent the rest of the war doing that.
Was that in the Philippines?
Well, it started in the Philippines. When they moved to us, I reported to the Philippines. It turns out the headquarters were in Australia, but I did a lot of traveling all through there, and then we all moved up to the Philippines. So I would say that about the 18 months I was overseas, about 6 of them were spent in Australia, and the rest of it in the Philippines.
When were you then discharged?
Discharged probably in April, end of April 1946.
Had you been giving thought to returning to graduate school all along?
I've been writing to Kirkwood and people. I had no question in my mind, too.
So you had planned to go back to
Yeah, I went, right, I went right back and started summer session that year. That's why I started summer session of 1946.
And you did your PhD thesis with Kirkwood?
No.
Or with
no. With Long. Well, what happened was, he was a sort of a nice, absent-minded guy. Kirkwood worked out for the best. And so when I got there, he had told me, things have changed. I mean, there were all kinds of things. I had told him that I wanted to come on my own. I just got married, and there was a GI Bill of Rights. And I said I wanted to come back on my own. I'd been corresponding with him on and off. He was a very, very nice gentleman. And I said that I didn't want to be a teaching assistant. I mean, I've now spent four years, but I didn't want to waste any more. I just wanted to get right going with my program, and I was going to be able to finance myself. Between the GI Bill and my wife working, we figured we could do that. So when I got to Cornell, it was in probably early June, he was very nice and very apologetic that he had not realized that the Cornell faculty had passed a rule that they weren't taking any graduate students in post-war unless they were some type of assistant. And it could be either a teaching assistant or a research assistant. Well, a research assistant was a category that was completely foreign to me, because when I had left in 1942, there was no such thing. You were either a teaching assistant or you were paying your own way. And there were a fair number of people who were doing that. And then he explained to me the facts of life. And he said, well, the problem was I could sign up with him and be a teaching assistant. There was no problem. He had everything there. Or if I wanted to, his friend Frank Long, who I'd known from my undergraduate days, had a grant or a project. I didn't know what he was talking about, really, because it was all foreign to me. And he was looking for people, and he talked to him about me, and I could give it a try. And if I didn't like it after a year, he would guarantee me that he would have a research assistant for me in June following. Well, I didn't have much choice. I didn't want to, I mean, I did have a choice, but I decided, well, we take a chance with Long, because you're not going to get much done the first year anyway, and I didn't want to spend, you could take all your courses. And so I turned out that the choice, the decision was not mine, because Kirkwood at the end of that year picked himself up and went to Caltech. And I was in the position for a lot of personal reasons to go out with him. And it was, I worked with, did my PhD with Long. And there I did get an introduction, a more detailed introduction into polymers.
What kind of, I want to come back to that, but what kind of graduate courses did you take then?
Well, when I came back, I was sort of at Cornell, been a tradition at that time that you have a major and two minors. And physical chemistry majors, traditionally, almost without exception, took physics and math minors. And so my graduate courses in chemistry in the first year and a half just consisted of statistical mechanics and quantum mechanics, and the rest of my coursework was advanced physics and advanced math. I don't know what they do now, but that was it was pretty much standard sort of thing, and you took physics through at least the physics quantum mechanics and math through what course they called advanced calculus, but it was really a course of mathematical methods for physics and chemistry, and they're very highly advanced. And so you sort of worked yourself up to those courses. And that's
who did you have for these courses, instructors?
Well, chemistry, Kirkwood taught the statistical mechanics. That was the first term I came back. And then the second term, he took leave, and then he came back and said, anybody wants to come with me? He was very gentleman. I was included. And that's, he came to me and said, I'm leaving, but if you want to come to Caltech, I have a place for you. And I thought over him a lot of reasons. So he did the stat mech. I had some young fellow second term, did the quantum mechanics. I think his name was John Bragg, but he left and went back and went to GE. In physics, it was Richard Feynman, who was at Cornell at the time, taught the electrodynamics course. And Beta taught the mechanics course. There were people, I mean, I don't think, okay. And in the math, the advanced calculus course was, they changed the name, was taught by Mark Kotz. Now, these were great courses and great teachers. And they certainly gave one a base for doing things. Doing okay?
Oh, yes, we're doing fine. When did you first meet Carl Florey? I think you said the Baker Lecture.
I tried to meet him. I think I have to go back to my thesis. My thesis with Frank Long was on the sorption of vapors through polymer films. Now, how he came about that, he had done some work in the war, and this was sort of interest, and that's what his support was. And one of the things, although the prime emphasis was on the kinetics of the process, you wound up with an equilibrium sorption, and consequently you calculate activity coefficients. And these were the films we were using were cellulose acetate films. And there was a very new theory then called the Flurry-Huggins theory. See, this was, say, about 1946 and a half or 47 that we started to get some data. And this stuff wasn't fitting at all. And then I noticed at an ACS meeting in New York around that time, I can't remember the year, maybe 47, that Flurry was giving three papers. So I tried to, I listened to the papers, and I tried to talk to them. This was a problem that was bothering me. I was rather a precocious young lad, I guess. And I think, well, hell, this whole theory of his was all wrong, and he and I would have a little talk about it. But he was always surrounded by a large number of people, and I couldn't get really to, I was precocious, but also very polite in a way, so I saw him for the first time, but never really got to meet him. I met him for the first time when he came to give the Baker lectures. And that was in the spring of 1948, spring term of 1948, as we just refreshed our memories.
We'll come back to that, but sure. Were there any other student college at the graduate level in those days?
There were a few. I was thinking about this the other day, and I'm sure I'm going to forget some. There was a fellow named Bill McDevitt who started with Kirkwood and switched to Frank Long, because he couldn't go to California either. And he finished perhaps maybe a month or two after I did, about the same time. And he went to work for DuPont, and I think spent all of his days in DuPont and recently retired. Working with Lynn Horn, who did X-ray crystallography, whose name was, are we on the air?
Mm-hmm.
Whose name was Seymour Geller, who I remember taught physical chemistry undergraduate, was a crystallographer, was a very eminent one, and particularly a boring crystal structure. Boron chemistry. And Seymour went to Bell Labs and a few other places and wound up at the University of Colorado, where I think he still is. There was a organic friend of mine, Lou Verstendig, Verstendig, who worked with Johnson, and he went to work for a company, went to work for Chevron, and then came east to work with a small company. Those were the people whose names as a graduate student. Well, then in Long's group, there was Paul Drexel, who went to work for Hercules. And there were, unfortunately, I might mix up the postdocs and these a long time ago, but in the graduate days. There was a fellow, Ken Coffin, who was from New England, who worked with Simon Bauer, who married one of Frank Long's graduate students. Her last name was Dunkel. I can't remember her first name. And they went to work at Cleveland, at the big NASA lab in Cleveland. And those are the people I remember. Those who I remember mostly over this time frame.
You received your PhD in 49.
Yeah, in June 49. Yeah.
You stayed on, but had you given thought to looking elsewhere?
Yeah, well, at that time, last year or so, I decided that what I had to do is go out and get an industrial job and make money. Frank Long was very much opposed to that. He tried to, we've been talked about this about the second, the third year when with him in the second year, and he said you ought to go do a postdoc somewhere. And he wanted to send me to Yale to work with Raymond Fuas. I kept saying no, I didn't want to. Well, strange as it may seem, in 1949, well, two things happened. I really got interested in what Flurry was doing. But again, this whole idea of postdocs was a whole new concept. And strange as it may seem, in 1949, there were jobs, but there weren't jobs that I had. I remember, I think I had two jobs, one of which I remember. Which is one that was in Tonawanda, New York, working on inorganic phosphors. And I just couldn't see, I forgot the name, I think it was a carbide subsidiary. I can't remember the name of the company at that time. I had another offer of the same kind, and I just couldn't see, really, I wasn't interested. I mean, the last thing I was interested in was inorganic chemistry, where, I mean, a lot of people are, and there's nothing wrong with it. I wasn't interested in it. And then Paul Flurry had come to Cornell that academic year. And Frank Long told me he was looking for postdocs, and he knew me from the Baker lectures, and if I were interested, along with, I mean, I think they had it rigged already, or I talked about it, but if I was interested, he thought that he would talk to Paul Florian, and I mean, so we, my wife and I decided that maybe we better give this a shot, and that was probably the smartest, from a professional point of view, decision I ever made in my life. But as I say, there were jobs, you know, choice jobs, and jobs that you might be interested in, didn't seem to be, at least for me, very much opportunity. 49, 48 were very bad years, I mean, in terms of, as you know, chemistry, even, you know, 16 months ago, 18 months ago, my phone was ringing off the hook for companies wanting to hire people. Now my phone's ringing off the hook for students here, there, people are not looking for jobs. So I, that's the way chemistry's always been, I guess, and this was that way at that time. So I should say, this is what I decided to do, and so we started in mid-June or July 1949. And I say this was, if I ever made a decision, that was a good one. That was that one. And I stayed with Paul through the end of 1951.
Was this your introduction to polymer crystallinity when you started working with him?
Yeah, well, I mean, my introduction, well, I should go back and say that when I finally got Florey at the I use this as a very often as an introduction to my giving a talk, when I finally got him to talk to him during the Baker lectures, and one of the lectures, of course, one of the subjects was the Florey Huggins thing, and I said, look at all this data we have, and I could get down to his office. And he says, well, he says, Leo, the reason it doesn't work is that cellulose acetate's crystalline. Well, of course, I didn't know what he meant, and then some people say, I'm still trying to find out. and that was the, well, but what happened, he had a, when I went to work as a postdoc, he had two basic supports. At that time, I already began to know how things were starting to work in academia. He had come, well, I guess it had been set up for him. He had come with it was the old Rubber Reserve Project, that Speed Marble, and you read about this, that Reconstruction Finance that was still going, and Peter Debye had a big chunk in. And he had a new grant from the Allegheny Ballistics Laboratory, which was a essentially making propellants for the government and were run by Hercules. And they were very enlightened management there, and they were interested in learning some of the basic properties, and we did a lot of work then on cellulosics, and went back to cellulose derivatives, not nitrous, one piece of work on nitrous cellulose, and that's how I got introduced into the crystallinity. I did two sort of things when I was at Cornell. Florey published a very basic paper on crystallinity in 1949, a theoretical paper, and the substance of it, or the issues of it, was is melting crystalline free to a phase transition. And he had already indications from work had done at Goodyear. You know, he came to Cornell from Goodyear. Some work on polyesters that indeed it was, and it was my job not to say it was, but to find out more, look more at melting points, excuse me, and the effects of diluents, the effect of copolymerization, things like that on melting points, and doing a fair amount of work with cellulose derivatives, but being able to branch into other polymers. And recollecting in those days, there was no linear polyethylene. Branch polyethylene had just been sort of come along. I mean, they had it during World War II, but it just was, its properties were just coming out in the literature in those days. And so one task I had, or one sort of general assignment, was to see from what we could do, say, experimentally, whether there's or not, because as he told me many times, you can set up a theory to go either way, depending on what you feed into it, and he was pretty well convinced that this was the way it was, but then it did turn out to be that way. So one of the things we accomplished from just a straight experimental point of view was to show that we did indeed had a bona fide classical first-order phase transition. And the other thing along the crystallization line that's of some interest to me is we started playing, if that's the right word, or exploring crystallization kinetics. But one of the things Florey let you, if he thought you had anything at all that was halfway sound, he at least let you go and try it out for a while. And so what we did, we were doing our melting temperature work dilatometrically, which is a pretty, we're going back to doing some of it now, it's a pretty good classical way of doing it. So as you did the melting, it seemed sort of interesting to me, say, let's see how these things crystallize. So we take them from the melt and we stick them at some temperature, and we had a whole bunch of constant temperature bounds. And the other thing that Florey believed in, he had a small group, and he believed that I guess they did, I'm just looking back, if his postdocs were any good, he got them assistance. So I had a couple of assistants, one to start with, and go as, you know, he'd been given to you all at once. Mm-hmm. And so we had these baths, and he also gave me one time one of his graduate students for a summer student to be paid on the grant. And that summer, We worked out pretty well the melting process, and it was getting to be sort of routine. You had to decide what polymer to make your diluent mixtures, and it all took a lot of time. So once we had a good sample in the dilatometer, particularly the pure polymers, we just looked at the inverse process. And this was in 1950-51, a long time ago. And then we found this fantastically strong negative temperature coefficient. In other words, if we were close to the melting point, nothing happened. And if we went down a few degrees, it would start to go, and 10 to 15 degrees would go very fast. And I must say, it certainly puzzled me, and I would say, if he were here, he would agree, if you remember, that it puzzled Paul Florey. And we were sitting on this, and then I did it on polyethylene oxide, and he said, well, I'll try it on some polyester, and then I tried it on polyamide that somebody had made, and it worked the same kind of thing. And until we became aware, about 6 months before I left Cornell, less than that, of Turnbull's work on the nucleation of mercury droplets, this is a very interesting thing, did we really understand what we had. And the reason, the way we learned about Turnbull's thing was he gave an ACS tour lecture at Cornell. And in those days they were at they used to be at the evening. And so one night, I know this is about 6 months before I left, 5 or 6 months before I left, we're out there, and you know, this Cornell wasn't a great big place, and so we went up there, and this guy, I don't know what the, see, you got to remember, in the usual physical chemistry curriculum and polymers, and even this classical concepts of nucleation never come in. If you go back and look at your textbook, you have to look far and back at the end of the book if you find it. And here's this very nice lecture on droplets of mercury and the temperature coefficient and what was happening, and Florey comes by to me, he says, let's get together with Turnbull tomorrow morning. And it became abundantly clear what we had, and then we did a few more experiments, and I did the analysis, and I took the stuff with me and wrote it up when I went to the Bureau of Standards. But it was perhaps an interesting example. I suspect we would have found out sooner or later, but it may have been later, as to what we're dealing with, because not in his experience, and certainly not in my limited experience, had we ever run across nucleation phenomena, which has this very characteristic. So I think that I could say pretty clearly or fairly that we were the first there to quantitatively establish the important role that nucleation processes played in polymer crystallization way back in 1951. Papers came out, I think, in 52, 53. There were two papers prior to really knowing anything else about things, and I wrote the papers up very early on when I went to the Bureau of Standards. But that's back to your question, that's how I got introduced to the crystallization, and these are the kind of things. We also did some other things which I think were important, which I don't do much recently, and that's we do work on solution. I did some work on some, not we did, there were a lot of things going on in the lab, and I did some work on solutions. At that time period, 1949-50, he had been doing a lot of work with Tom Fox, and I'll mention some of the people who were in the lab if you want to later. Mm-hmm. And their major focus was on the relationship of intrinsic viscosity to molecular weight and the thermodynamic nature of the solvent. The intramolecular excluded volume effect, the theta temperature, things of that sort, were the kinds of things were evolving. And he and Fox had published, I think they had started, the lab was functioning when I joined it. I think they had started some of this work at Goodyear, because Fox came with Florey from Goodyear. They were publishing, of course we had preprints of the papers, and he made sure everybody knew what was going on in the lab. And so they had all this nice set of papers. There's a Fox-Florey set of four or five papers, 1949 and 1950, in the JACS on the viscosity relations to molecular weight and the intramolecular excluded volume effect. And Florey was teaching a polymer course one term. I remember I asked him, could I sit in on the course? He says, oh, don't waste your time, you know everything. So I didn't. And one day he came back from his lectures with a book under his arm. He says, you know, Leo, I think that the sedimentation velocity might be treated the same way as Tom and I had. Fox was still there, but he was involved in glass temperature work and a lot of other things. The same way that Tom and I treated the intrinsic viscosity. So my first question was, what's sedimentation velocity? And he said, well, why don't you read this? And it's a chapter in a book by Svedberg or somebody. And so we dug through the literature, I did, and it did turn out that you could treat the sedimentation velocity the same way you did the intrinsic viscosity. And then we found out that you can combine the sedimentation velocity with the intrinsic viscosity and have essentially a universal behavior, and a set of constants then that were universal to all chain molecules. And what was interesting is that there was a young instructor at Cornell, Harold Chiraga, who we just, well, he came, I think, in 47. And what they were having at Cornell then were polymer seminars at night. Maybe there were 10 people, professors and students, 12 people, interested in polymers. So maybe every other week we'd meet and have a seminar. And I got to meet Harold, and he got to learn, hear about what was going on, what I call these hydrodynamic, these flow properties. And he sort of suggested to me maybe we could apply these ideas to the hydrodynamic properties of proteins. And so we did. We set out to look at this, and it didn't take very long because it wasn't really that complicated. And we were able to do that, and we worked out what is known now in the textbooks. I'm not bragging, but it's there, the Chiraga-Mandelkern equation for the sedimentation, viscosity, what you. And the other thing that was, and so we were actually, Harold called me up one Sunday morning about 7 o'clock after we were talking, because I think I see how to do it now. And he likes to work pretty hard. And we'd asked Flurry to join us as a co-author, because we'd been talking to him on and off, and but he never, it wasn't, you know, the idea was between Harold and myself, and we would just say, well, this sounds good, or I keep going, or something like that, or pat us on the back. And he was a senior person, I guess 99 people out of 100 would have said, sure, stick my name on. He said, no, you did it all yourself. And so we had a lot of battles with the referees, but we battled it all through. And so I just thought I'd mention, Harold and I are, and our families have been friends since that time, which is, what we say, 40 years ago. So it's,
yes, I think that's picker number 12 on your list.
Oh, you have a list there. Okay, yeah, that's consideration of the hydrodynamic properties of proteins. Yeah.
1953.
Yeah, okay, that was done, actually, you see. The work was done while I was still at Cornell, and there was about a year's battle.
Really that long?
With the I had to go back to Cornell with Harold, and with Albert Noyes was the editor of the JACS. And boy, Flurry at one time said, you want me to interfere? We said, we were two young kids. We said, no, we're going to do this ourselves. And of course, we were having a real, somewhere is the correspondence that I, anytime I get discouraged with anything, guys, let's look at that, because that was actually a good lesson. And there was a lot of entrenched feeling and a lot of misconceptions. And also, we obviously were very naive, very green, and the paper maybe not as been as clear the first three versions until we got it right. But Noyes, I would suspect that maybe he was checking behind our back with Flurry, and he would say, well, come back and have another go with the referees. And we finally figured out who the referees were, so we could then respond, knowing we could see where they were coming from and respond to things. So it took at least a year, before we got the referee stuff. So that's why it came out in 53. We actually did the work when I was still Cornell. Yeah, that caused quite a stir in a lot of circles. But that was part of the work that we had done, and to say it was just sort of an open lab, so we just took these trends that were in the lab. And
was this part of the resistance to the whole concept of polymers that developed even earlier than that?
No, this was not a development to the concept of polymers. This was a resistance. No, because I don't think it's proper to surmise who the referees were. But I think this was in part their not understanding. Now, they become pretty ardent, actually. And also there was a whole school that had very strong vested interest in a certain kind of idea of how you treat a solution of a protein. I think it was a combination of that, and mainly that they didn't understand the polymer stuff that we were doing. Now, that's understandable. It was very, very, new. Because I think that once they understood it, and there was no problem. And I think part of it is that we were sort of green and we didn't write a very clear paper. But I just remember Noyes being tolerant. I know I wouldn't. I mean, he just let us come back and said, as long as you want to keep making a stab and revising it, I'll be with it.
You were actually spent 3 years as a postdoc.
About two and a half.
A long time?
Two and a half years. No, it was two. It came in June, July 49, and left at the end of 51. So it's
okay.
Yeah, that maybe in those times, it's about a good time. I know most of the postdocs between 2 and 3 years is a... Well, the problem there was, well, first place, Paul Flurry treated us financially reasonably well. So we didn't make any money, but we weren't starving. Fact is, when I took my first job at the Bureau, I went there for less money, a little bit less money than I was making it as a postdoc. And it was very exciting times. I mean, it was hard to leave. I mean, it was very hard to leave. I mean, I realized I had to leave, but and I'm glad I did leave. You know, some people stick on and on and on. But if I have a good postdoc here over the years since I've been here, I'll tell them after they've been here 6 or 7 months and I feel they're good ones. I said, well, unless something unusual turns up, somewhere between 2 and 3 years is a good time to stay, because you really get cranked up and you can develop sort of your own reputation, and you learn and mature a lot, and it helps you then. No, it was hard to leave. I mean, I'm sure that I could have talked Florida to let me stay another year or two, but I felt I just time was gone. But we weren't hurting in the sense that we were able to make ends meet, because I forgot what the pay was, but it was about $400 or $500 more than I made my first job at the Bureau of Standards. But he was fairly liberal, and he gave you help in the lab, and it was very nice. And no, it was very hard to leave.
Did he come into the lab every day?
Well, I don't know if he came in every day, but he was very close. Oh, yeah. He'd come to the office. But you felt as though you had no problems. If you knew he was around, if you just stuck around long enough, he'd talk to you more than one time. I mean, he always kept his group small, at least in the days of Cornell and out there, so that there were Bill Krigbaum, Tom Fox, myself with the postdocs, Alan Schultz, I was a graduate student. I think there was one other graduate student that drifted away from Polymers. I forgot his name. So I think he never had more of 4 or 5 people, either total students and postdocs, working with him in those days. So,
did you socialize at all?
Yeah, he used to have parties at his house. Cornell was a very congenial sort of place, and we got to know his wife, and she was very helpful in terms of helping us with our little child at the time. And she was very pleasant, and he had a boat. He would invite us out, to me and other people in the lab, to sail on some afternoon. So we had picnics, and we kind of... Cornell in the wintertime is pretty hard to do anything, but I remember one Christmas we were... Although we don't celebrate Christmas, he knew we were in Ithaca by ourselves, and he said, "Why don't you come over Christmas afternoon? We'll have something to drink." And he showed us some movies, and it was very... I remember it was a nice wintry day, and that snowy day, I put the chains on the car those days. But he was very, very nice. He was nice all that. Very, very, what's the right word? Not demanding. High standards. Really wanted excellence in everything. You learned how to do an experiment, because if you had something, even if it substantiated his theory, you said, "Well, let's try it this way to see if it's right." And very, very look at, not the man, but in the sense of really want to be sure of everything, a perfectionist. That's the right word. He sat on stuff until he, on theories and stuff, and even experiments, until we did it this way and that way, and then got another fraction and extended the molecular weight range. And was very, I mean, that's the way you have to do things, and I still think there are a few people who still do it that way. The perfectionist is the word, very demanding in that sense. Not demanding that, you know, you snap a whip at you, or that I got misquoted in the, or misunderstood in an article in Chemical Engineering News. It was demanding in the sense of being perfect, doing everything right. And so he told me, as I found out, he said, "You work all you want. I'll tell you, I can tell if you're working or not." And I tell that to my students here. You don't have to stand there and hold a whip over them. So in the sense of really wanting to be excellent, I mean, he really, really, in all the people who are closely associated with him, he really developed in us a passion for excellence, I can say that. I don't know if we've achieved it, but he certainly got that instilled in us. And I think that, taking away what he did scientifically from a... that I think is his hallmark, is, I would say, is a passion for excellence.
The position at NBS, how did that come about? Did he ask you to give you the advice you give your students, or did you decide to leave on your own?
No. Well, we decided, in terms of leaving, we sort of mutually decided it. And jobs were not too bad at that period. And working with Flory, you know, we got a lot of interviews, and you visit a lot of places. And I had a job offer. Well, I went down to DuPont, and they had two jobs. One was in the newly developing polyethylene terephthalate fiber group that they had there. And one was in this place that they were going to run for the Atomic Energy Commission. I was not interested, but at Savannah River. And I've forgotten which one they offered me, but I was seriously considering it when he told me that L.A. Wood who was a was at the Bureau of Standards, was one of the early pioneers who'd done anything quantitative in polymer crystallization and polymer transitions, was looking for somebody to replace somebody there, and maybe I ought to think about the job going there. And I thought about it, and the pay there was a heck of a lot less than the DuPont, but again, it was not. And he explained a lot of things to me and strongly urged me to go to the Bureau of Standards.
So he urged that position?
Yeah, well, as, yeah, I mean, he and he recommended, obviously, for it very strongly, and so that's why I went down there.
And you had a number of papers, of course, that you were writing after you left Cornell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you continue any work with him at the same time? Or
no, we essentially did not formally collaborate, as far as I know, except, well, I wouldn't say that. At that time, we certainly did. I haven't checked over the publication list. There was one time, there's a paper we have where my very good friend now, Malcolm Dole, had written the paper, which was all wrong. I know it's gone on tape, but please edit this out, okay? My good friend Malcolm Dole, very good friend Malcolm Dole now, who's quite a nice gentleman, had published a paper involving small size crystallites and their melting, which had some errors in it, let's say. And so Flory and I sort of recognized this where I was, and I probably called him up and said, and so we wrote a small note. Now that, I think, there may be another, no, I don't think he was involved in any of the other things. That's the only formal work that I know of, except for the work we did at Cornell. Now, I may be wrong, I have to check the list, because when he came back from England, from his leave, he had published this very beautiful paper in the JACS on contractility and dimensions. That really got me excited, and I went up and I didn't understand it all, and I talked to him about it. And I think he may be on that first paper with Roberts and myself on the dimensional changes in rubber as a consequence of cross-linking. And that might be the only other time we actually formally collaborated, and we could check that.
Where
the idea was, if you stretched a polymer and cross-linked it when it was stretched, an amorphous polymer, or had it, then when you relaxed it, it would still have some length. And that was a very intricate kind of logic, and it was very difficult for me to follow. And then, I remember going up to Cornell, and we just figured out how to do the experiment, and I went back and I did the experiment at the Bureau, and it did turn out to be. Right, I think that and the Dole's, the thing about Malcolm Dole was just a small letter to the Journal of Polymer Science. We talked a lot, interacted a lot over the years on many things, but I think it's a formal paper writing system. My memory isn't so high, we have to go to the list, but that's my recollection. There are some things early on in the Bureau of Standards, but they were left over from Cornell that we were. Yeah, we worked very hard those days. We did a lot of work.
Yes, there's quite a number of papers. Yeah. Quite a number of papers that came out of that brief period.
Well, see, he also believed in having his students, his postdocs, work. You know, so I would work with Bill Krugbaum together, or something, or with Jack Hensinger, and we would both be authors. Mm-hmm. But we each have made substantial contributions because they sort of naturally crossed each other. And he was a great believer in, at least I think he was. At least that's the way it came down. When we have our teleconferences, which the ACS has a teleconference course, and they give a mighty us a big microphone, and it's terrible because you're stuck for an hour and a half, and the last one was very bad, I guess, and I got very horrible comments about
that all the students fill out. And something like this, you can walk around and move. Yeah.
And of course, we get much better tape quality this
way. Yeah, well, this is, they have to be able to put this on a telephone, but I'm sure they can.
They should be able to.
Okay, so where were we?
Well, we were just finishing up your comments about your relationship with Paul Fauré up through the early NBS days.
Yeah.
And I guess my next question then, starting at NBS, was what was your first assignment? What was your position when you went there in 52?
Okay, well, at those days, we talk about those days, particularly about the MBS, the MBS was organized into divisions. There was a heat and power division and some electricity and magnetism, and there was an organic and fibrous material division. And in 1952, then each division was subdivided into sections. And in 1952, all the sections were named essentially commodity lines. There was a textile section and a leather section and a plastic, I don't remember them all, and a plastic section and a testing section and a rubber section. And as I mentioned earlier, L.A. Wood was the one who had the position. He was chief of the rubber section. Now, among these commodity sections, the rubber section was somewhat unique because about half of its activity were in basic research. Now, basic research connected with polymers, with rubbers, but there was a long tradition there because the other senior person there was Norman Beckedahl, who's still alive, living in Pompano Beach. They had, early on, L.A. Wood was a physicist and Norm Beckedahl was a chemist, both PhDs. They had early on started to do, 1932, there are some papers by Beckedahl on calorimetry and specific heats of natural rubber. I mean, they were just pioneering. They didn't understand, nobody knew what a polymer was yet in those days, but then their stuff still stands up and is extraordinarily good data. And then Wood came along and he got interested in transitions and melting, and they actually did the first crystallization kinetics using natural rubber, and did some work on melting temperatures and the dependence of melting temperatures on crystallization temperature. So they were quite cognizant of the importance of this kind of work to what their main objectives were, being able to set standards for rubber tires and gaskets. That's what, at the other end of the funnel, so to speak, was happening. And so the section was sort of split in, I'd say, roughly half or one-third, two-thirds. But this commodity influence pervaded everywhere, you see. And it was very, in many ways, it was frustrating because it was difficult to get across to some of the, except for Wood and Beckedahl, to some of the leaders, the older people who headed the things. You know, there's a thing called polymers coming on. It's 10 years old now, and these are what you're dealing with. And on the other hand, for a young fellow, my first few years at the Bureau, I feel as well, were great years because I was on my own. They put very little restraint, some administrative restraints. A lot of the rules and regulations of the government were a little hard to live with. But scientifically, intellectually, they put very little restraint for the first few years. And that was my first assignment, then, to sort of jump ahead in the organization. They finally recognized that there was a thing as polymers, and so they set up a new section called the Polymer Structure Section, which eventually, not the first one off, but eventually Norm Beckedahl got the head. He was the second head. And I would say this was probably about 56, 58 or something like that. And then he'd asked me, and took a little bit of a behind-the-scenes maneuvering, and I moved without getting too many feathers ruffled, for me to move up. There was a different building to move into the polymer structure section, which essentially took away any of the commodity things. But I didn't feel tremendously stifled in the rubber section to start with. Although, if I had wandered too far away from transitions, crystallinity, and glass temperatures, I think there would have been some mutterings. But so the first 5 or 6 years, I think that they let me do what I wanted, promoted me in proper order, and gave me some help, and we published. There was no restraints on publication. It was encouraged.
Did you have a patent also?
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, that
was,
That was sort of like a hobby sort of thing, and just that somebody came through and said, well, you did that, you had somebody from industry. We're always getting visitors. One of the things I didn't like about the Bureau of Standards was the fact that even with appointments and even without appointments, somebody would call up and say, John Jones from so-and-so is here, and he's interested in crystalline polymers. Well, you work for the government, he was a citizen, and then you'd have to do that. And that happened. And also, a lot of people like to come to Washington, so even with appointments, you had to be nice. People would come from all over the world, which is all right, in moderation. But when you got to do 3-4 visitors a week in the springtime, it got to be a little too much. But that patent was failed. Well, it was an interesting scientific thing, but the patent was that somebody from industry came by and said, well, you ought to patent that. So I called up the Bureau of Patent people, and they said, well, and they did what they had to do. And we can get to what's involved there. It was part of why I left. One of the reasons, not the major reason, but one of the reasons, the science of it. Yeah, the Bureau to start with was very good, because I nobody bothered me. I didn't have to worry about anything administrative, and as long as they could give me reasonable leeway, and they gave me two technicians.
What kind of areas did you pursue then?
Well, primarily in the crystallization area, and some work in glass temperatures, and some collaborative work when I moved into the polymer structure section on solution work. It's back on my old thing with several of the people who were doing solution work, and I just, without bragging, felt I needed a little guidance, and so we got along pretty well. So we did in the papers there was some work on sedimentation equilibrium and sedimentation velocity, and I sort of was like a consultant. But I contributed in terms of saying, well, we're making this effort, why don't we do it this way and learn something scientifically out of it. But basically, the heart of what I did was on some work on glass temperatures, but mostly on crystallization. Are we coming through okay?
Mm-hmm.
Crystallization on the thermodynamics and on the kinetics. Those were the two things that I... we did a whole series of papers on thermodynamics of natural rubber, gutta percha, polyethylene. You just name them. We just established some more of the principles and did a lot of work on kinetics and work on glass.
Who were some of your co-workers?
In the polymer structure section, the people who would do, besides Norm Bechdel and Wood, who were very nice, because they were actually bosses. Bechdel wasn't the boss, but he was very senior. But they were people you could at least have a reasonable scientific discussion with. And there was Bob Marvin, who he may have just retired, who was a rheologist, a student of John Ferry's, and he moved over to some other part of the Bureau to set up a general rheology section somewhere along the lines, I think. And then there was Herb Liederman, who passed away at a rather early age while I was still at the Bureau. He was a rheologist doing things like creep. And again, this was all very pioneering. I mean, you got to put it in the times. I mean, people weren't doing these things on a systematic. People knew there was such a thing as creep, anybody who made a rubber. But nobody was really trying to study it from a fundamental point of view. So those are the people there. Then in the polymer structure section, there was Sam Weisberg, who was doing solution work. And Don McIntyre joined us, who's now at the University of Akron. And we had John D. Hoffman with us for a while, but he moved over to another part of the Bureau to set up his own group, which is another story in itself. But those were the main people that were involved. A very important person who is an organic synthesis and mechanism of degradation, Leo Wall, who died in a sailing accident a few years after I left the Bureau. But he was one of the senior. I mean, he wasn't old. He was about my age, but at that time, but was one of the more productive scientists in the place. And he was in the polymer structure section also. And we were sort of two parts. We had the physical chemical part and the organic synthesis degradation. Leo made some major contributions to the degradation mechanisms of polymers, and then got interested in fluoropolymers.
You said that Bechdel was the second head of that polymer structure section. Who was the first?
First head was a fellow named Earl Schoonover, who was one time again head of the dental section, the dental materials section at the Bureau in that group too. And Schoonover was, he moved on to, I shouldn't make personal comments, moved on to be an associate director or somewhere in the director's office, rather influential actually in running the Bureau. Say the last 4 or 5 years I was here, he was probably the most influential person. I was there in running the Bureau from an operational point of view. The other people above him were pretty much dealing with Congress and the President and all that sort of stuff. And when he moved upstairs, so to speak, then Becadal, they were very good friends in Becadal. There was a whole, the Bureau, in terms of the people who were maybe 10, 15 years older than I, was really a close-knit corporation. I mean, there were a bunch of people that had grown up together, and they knew each other quite well, and lived together, and drank together, and played together, and it was a pretty closed corporation. So,
were there many newcomers like yourself coming in at that time?
There were some. It didn't have the big push that I understand it had lately. Positions were not that. And the newcomers that came in, we weren't interested in what these people were interested in. We were interested in trying to do science, and we got very frustrated sometimes in the directions. But these people were interested more in the politics of science. Not Norm Becadal, but all these other grouping people in that age group were more interested in the politics of science, I think, than in the... Then we're doing so. People are coming like myself, and they were hiring people, and a lot of physicists who are more interested in the science. And,
now you mentioned that the patent was one of the reasons why you ultimately decided.
It wasn't the patent itself; it was the subject matter of the patent. No, the patent was minor. No, you don't leave a place. I mean, actually, there were a lot of reasons. One of them was I had beginning to develop in a way. A real strong interest in going back to academics, which was I began to realize after this was say 1958, 59, 60, around that period. So I'd been away from the university for getting close to 10 years, and you don't teach, you don't read, you don't go to that many seminars. When you go to meetings, they were pretty good when you go to meetings, but you didn't have a weekly seminar. So you're beginning to lose touch with. You know, you're getting to learn how to make a right-hand thread better and better and better, and that's the way I used to express it. And I had one time I wrote a paper, and I made not a stupid mistake, but I thought something was novel, and it wasn't really. There's almost elementary thermodynamics to tell me that it wasn't. The referee pointed this out. And it sort of dawned on me that maybe I better start studying and learning and refreshing thermodynamics and statistical math. Well, there's no way you can do that except come back and teach. So that was one of the reasons. The other, in terms of that patent, there were three reasons that all sort of came together. And the patent involved the contractile fibers. We had, following up on that work I told you on the rubber, we followed this up with unhighly oriented polyethylene and found out if you cross-linked highly oriented polyethylene, and the Bureau was nice to have all these facilities for radiation, and Leo Wall was doing that and helped me. Then you can make a reversibly fiber that changed dimensions reversibly just by melting it. And this built this machine, the thermal engine, that was the patent. But the point is that led us into biological fibers and the whole subject of contractility. I mean, just naturally, I mean, nobody said that. Nah. Just sort of as you start reading more and more, and we did a lot of work in that Bureau period in keratin and collagen. And the collagen we could carry. We could justify a little bit because it was in the, they still had the commodity section. The Bureau did not have its reorganization in terms of institutes or what it is today until several years after I left. And so I was getting more interested in this, and it was getting, they hadn't really said anything, but Becadal was fine, but I was getting concerned about the people above him who were, because I was very difficult to be a GS-15. That Leo Wall and I were. And we were the only two there, thus far I know in the Bureau, who did not have, at that rank, who didn't have administrative responsibility. Hugo Fano, but he was made to be, I think, a consultant to the director. And his office was in the administrative building. See, Leo's and I were right in the lab like this. And there may have been others, I don't know, but he and I were the only two who knew, who had parking places. And, we had lunch in the director's lunch because that's a certain rank. But it was getting more difficult and difficult to say, well, why are you doing this and not directing a section and doing this and all sorts of that. And also the kind of work I was doing was getting away, you know. Well, you ought to be, they were muttering, well, you ought to be at NIH doing this, you see. And that wasn't the only thing we're doing, but it was looked then and still is as a very important kind of approach, using basically polymer principles to tackle problems in biological polymers. Particularly macroscopic systems, not the solution characterization. And then in the crystallization work, there were essentially three reasons. And this whole problem, I don't know if you know about it, of this folded chain started to rear its head. And that brought essentially John Hoffman and myself into direct conflict. As I mentioned, he was originally in the polymer structure section, and we got along pretty well. And then he moved over to head what was then the dielectric section, but really it was a device that he could set up his own research program, and this was in another division. But without going into a great deal of technical difficulty, this became a scientific issue, which could have been resolved. I mean, if we were just, I mean, there's no reason. I've seen plenty of people here and elsewhere. But it became basically a political situation of a rather serious import. And I was feeling quite harassed in my isolated position, okay? And so there were, basically, there was a, in that area, there was a complete misconception, either deliberate or accidental, and misuse of nucleation theory, which I felt very strongly to, which I've been using all the time, and I perhaps unfortunately let my opinions be known. And some people aren't going to let their fame or their potential fame rest on or be halted by something like that. So there was a great deal of harassment, internal problems, internal politics. So the whole things, you know, so as I started looking around, and as the expression goes, and this institute, this university was just developing, and Professor Kasha invited me down, and they made me, well, financially, was actually about the same as I was making at the Bureau, but the rest of it would look very attractive, and in 1962, things were looking very good, so I didn't have no regrets. This was the second best move I made, in a sense, although the Bureau was, you know, fine. I mean, I probably, if we didn't, I would say if this problem or this harassment of the folded chains didn't come along, I probably could have handled the other things, because I was beginning to make contacts with people at NIH, and we could have collaborated, and it was not, you know, driving down Wisconsin Avenue wasn't that great big a deal. And so the fact is, in that period, I did do a paper with Coleman Lockie on muscle, and we are doing... So that those other problems, I think, and I could have gotten to do some teaching if I wanted to in the Washington area. But everything coming together, and sort of, let's say, if this other science, sort of political science problem, science political problem, became very serious, actually, it's finally been resolved, hadn't come, I'd probably still be at the Bureau. Because, you know, I've never been down south before in our lives, and this was a big, but there's no regrets. We've enjoyed every minute of it here, and professionally and personally. But those were the, I've always told people, my students, and they never should leave a job for one reason, unless, you know, you, it has to be a set of reasons or circumstances that want to make a change. And do you have any questions about this? That's the Bureau period, I think. I have mixed yeah. feelings. I still see Wood. I still converse and have interactions with Norm Beckendahl. He's probably in his 80s now and retired in Pompano Beach. Wood was through Florida. He was here about 3 years ago. So those people have very good relations. But except for one trip back shortly after I left, I've never been there and never been invited there. I've been invited all over the world. That's one place. I had one trip back 3 or 4 months to clean up things. I was supposed to be back on a regular basis to clean up things. A lot of things never got cleaned up. But that's the way life is.
Had you discussed this with Florey at all?
My moving? Oh, yeah.
And the situation at the Bureau?
Oh, yeah. We discussed it on and off. I didn't burden him. It was at that time, you see. We both moved about the same time. He moved 1 year ahead of me, and he was having major problems too. So we could, in fact, we could commiserate with each other in a certain sense. You know, after all, we were on our own. I wouldn't see him every day or anything like that. But he knew there were problems here, and on this, and he encouraged me. He thought it was time for me to leave there if I felt strongly as I did that I wanted to do academic work. See, he moved to Stanford, I think, about a year or a year and a half before we did. I think he went to Stanford in 61, and oh yeah, because I remember. He knew that they knew I was coming out here before they even went to Stanford, because I remember going out to see him in Pittsburgh before he left, and then he was talking to one of his daughters, and he said I was going to be a professor at Florida State in a half year, because there was a half year interim before I came down. I just had too much going It's not like you're at a university where you bring your graduate students with you and take your equipment. I just had too many things going, so the deal we struck here was I came down in January rather than in September. I think I accepted the position in the spring, April or May, something like that, yeah. It took me two trips down to convince me that I could go down to Tallahassee, which is all right. It was a very good move. But we struck a deal here that I wouldn't have to come till January because... I say it's not like professors say, okay, fellas, pack up the wagons, we're all going to move to someplace else. I couldn't bring anything with me or any of the people. At that time, I had a lot of interactions. I had three or four technical people. They had a postdoctoral program, which every year somebody would come work for me as a postdoctoral. So I cleaned up most everything. There were a few things that could have been finished up, but eventually they got straightened out and started up over again.
Was Florida State the only place you looked at?
I looked at several other places, but this was the only one that made me an offer that I considered reasonable enough to. It was a very exciting place then. It was young. There were 10,000 students, a little under 10,000 or 22,000 then. There was a faculty in chemistry was very good then. And I presume it's still pretty good.
I wanted to ask you something about the origin of the molecular biophysics here, and you just said that it was forming when you...
It had been formed. What had happened, the person who basically formed it and involved it was Professor Michael Kashi, whose office is upstairs. He was a fairly eminent physical chemist, spectroscopist. And he'd gotten the idea, I guess from his perspective, it's very similar to mine. Well, he wired it into, I've forgotten, some area of triplet, singlet oxygen and found out how important this was, or apparently. So he found out again that here are these biology, biochemical people potting around with things or working on things that he could help them with. And so he'd gotten this idea, and I don't know all these. There were some acts of good coincidence that he was able to get an institutional grant from what was then the AEC. The theme originally, I believe, was to be radiation chemistry and biology, but I think that quickly, the time I got here, it was. And he got from the state the monies to put this building up. And this is a unique kind of situation. It was then, I still think it is now. This institute is only a physical facility. It is not an academic enterprise, in a sense. It doesn't. There's no professor of molecular biophysics. You're either a professor of chemistry or a professor of biology, and you happen to be working in the Institute of Molecular Biology. We have, indeed, members here who happen not to, there's not enough space, who are working elsewhere, and it fluctuates slightly. So the theme here was, and at that time, this cornerstone was a rather substantial institutional grant from the AEC. If I recall correctly, it was the order of magnitude of about $1 million in 1962, $800,000, $1 million, because I'm sure it was, because I was associate director effectively for several years and ran the guts of the place, and we were working with a budget from the AEC then of $700,000. So, and there was, we were on the, you know, and they supported it, so the state put up the building with some matching funds, I guess, from somewhere. And this was actually the first building on this part, first scientific building or academic building, if you wish, on this part of the campus. The only other thing was these dormitories, if you saw over here. Mm-hmm. The biology next door and chemistry came some years later. They were all on the other end of the campus. But this is not an academic institution. We also, in this university, give a degree in molecular biophysics, which started about 1969, which is a joint degree by the biology and chemistry departments. And of course, the institute per se, because of the faculty associated with it, sort of the focus of that program. But again, there are people having students in that program who are next door or next door here. So we profit by having interactions in theory and having central facilities. So that's basically what the institute is. Now, some years ago, we lost the central grant, and it's sort of everything is running on its own.
So each of the faculty that are involved would traditionally then supply their own?
Yeah, well, we all were doing some then, but right. We had the central thing. But as a consequence of how it originated, we have a set of central facilities. We have a shops. We have a... offices and people who take care of all the bookkeeping and paperwork, so it takes a burden also off the department. It sort of works both ways. If they took the five chemistry professors who are in this building and dumped them into chemistry, it would cause a great deal of problems for chemistry, I can assure you, and vice versa. There are about eight or nine people in here, four or five from chemistry or four or five from biology. It fluctuates slightly as people leave and somebody else moves in. But when I first came here, this building was just going up, and so I had temporary quarters in the old chemistry building, and I was the I, Rose, Kasia, actually the original people who still left to move into this, who were still in this building.
Who was the third one?
Rhodes, a young professor. He was a young assistant professor. He was he's a theoretical quantum mechanician. And I think I'm right. Yeah, there are still some people in chemistry who are here, but they moved into chemistry when the new chemistry, this big building here is a chemistry building.
You were director of the...
Well, I was associate director for about 4 years, I think 70 to 74 or 69, and I essentially did, took care of things. It was a fairly... It was a time-consuming thing because you had to make decisions how to distribute a fairly good-sized chunk of money, and you had a lot of interactions with the people in Washington and Gaithersburg. Took a lot out of me physically.
I was going to ask how you appreciated administrative aspects.
Not particularly. Well, and so, yes and no. Here, it was not that difficult. They were a pretty congenial crew here, and we got along reasonably well. We got pretty straight answers from the people in the AC, and so we had to embark on a program of trying to reach a steady state with them now in financing and working the rest up. And it wasn't too bad, except there was a lot. At any large state university, when you get into something like that, maybe any place, you just get into all the actual obligation, the responsibility wasn't so bad. That I could make the couple of trips a year to the AEC and work with the crew here, how we're going to distribute our money and hire. We have, administrative people, so, and they were pretty good. We had a pretty good crew. We had to do that. But it's the everyday thing of having to go to two, three meetings every week or every day. I mean, just I used to have two secretaries, and one was doing my work, and they would just, I got sick. I was out for a year for one time. They just point me in, and I go home and stay up all night doing my work, you see. And, you have to go to the science area committee, and then you'd have to go to the dean, have this, and the president, have that. I don't mean social functions. I mean, most of them are a waste of time, but you have to go to the building committee. If you didn't go, then somebody would take half your building away from you, you see. And so that really had to do because we had a good crew, and we had sufficient flexibility that... with a good lead time. You see, I had a colleague who was on leave in Sweden in those days making a long distance call. It looked like we were going to get a big budget cut, and I just called up Bob Fisher. I said, you better be prepared when you come back, all the money you thought you're going to have. Well, people could work with that. And so that part I was able to do all right. And we had some people who were technicians, and I told them, you better tell your technician the next year or two to find another job. At least that's why, because it looks like we're not going to be able to keep the crew that we have, and so nobody ever got really hurt. We have a pretty congenial sort of group to work with, and we managed to have competent people help us downstairs. But this other stuff killed me. I was out three. I was sick, right? I just couldn't take it. I mean, just maybe I don't know about your place, but it's and I felt the responsibility very strongly. I knew if I didn't go to a meeting of the building committee, that somebody's going to take a lab away from us. And
in the let's change pace sure. for a moment. In the I think it's the award citation for the ACS Polymer Award. Mm-hmm. The number of statements that are made. Well, you were called Mr. Crystalline Polymer, and you have two books that I wanted to go back to. First one, 64, and the Crystallization of Polymer. Mm-hmm. What led up to the writing of that book?
Well, several. There were. I haven't thought about that in some time, but I think that there were several intellectual reasons and scientific reasons, and also the physical situation, the timing was right. At that time, with the work that Florey had done and the work I had done with him and a lot of other people, one could begin to see, I think, the basics of the subject. And at the same time, there was a lot of this new work on morphology that was coming in that had a lot of elements of merit, but also was beclouding the perspective of the problem I thought was being lost. So that's, I feel there was very basic science that could be discussed, and I felt something I was subject I was obviously close to. I'd been working on it since 1949, and I think that the new work on morphology and structure and the lamellar crystallized, which were important, were, at least if they weren't incorrect, which turned out most of them were, but at that time at least they were, a lot of ideas were being propounded without really substantive thing, and the whole subject I thought was getting out of perspective. And since I knew I was going to be moving sooner or later, I mean, at this time I started the book in say 60-61, so I came here with a first draft, a rough draft, and then as I said, the labs weren't ready when I came here, so I was able to really, I had a little cubbyhole in the library and then finished it up. Did that answer your question, Mr.? That's what sort of promoted it. Are we off the tape?
I'm going to have to.
Well, I would say that originally it wasn't received red hot because of the climate. I mean, but I would say now, well, every time I go to a meeting, people say, "When are you going to put out a new edition?" So I feel in many ways vindicated. The only person who really gave it a good review was Maury Huggins, in the sense that he realized what I was trying to bring. Okay, he didn't agree with everything I said, but I mean, it was really lambasted by several people. To be perfectly honest, I mean, it sold out. I mean, eventually they don't make massive printing, so that part. But it was not, I don't think, originally received. Certainly it disappointed me. But I feel quite gratified because it was, in essence, correct. And I say, I'm going to go to a meeting, go anywhere now, and somebody says, "When are you putting out?" It's hopelessly out of date. And in fact, I hope I was last long enough to get around to work it over. It's got to be worked over from stem to stern, so to speak. But I feel quite good about it actually now, because as I say, people just say and they introduce me to me, and they introduce me as the author of this book. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the reviews that appeared in some of the journals. Well, I don't think we. A historians can go look it up. Okay, the only one I want to say is Maury Huggins, who didn't agree with me completely, but at least he saw what I was trying to say and wrote a reasonably objective. I mean, but there were reviews of saying this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's back in the dark ages and refuses to recognize what everybody knows, that chains are regularly folded. Obviously, you can see them in the electron microscope. Well, that was a lot of. Incorrect stuff, and it's all clear now what the problem is and where the problems are. And unfortunately, I think we were subject for about a 15 to 20 year period to what might be called propaganda if we were in Russia, or advertising if we were in New York. And it was one of these things. And now, for a long time here, this I was sort of sitting alone with the 2-3 people in the world and saying that this stuff is just can't be right from experiment. And then Florey had one theory, and then recently sort of wiped it all out with a recent theory. But the experiments just didn't add up. And but it was very difficult to be heard, and there was a lot of it was very difficult to be heard for a long time.
What about when you would give papers at meetings?
Well, as I say, you could give. You weren't invited to too many invited papers, but you can go, make a contributor paper, and they'd listen to you, I guess. But there were many a meeting in the 60s, almost every year, that we were just excluded. Mm. No, I always, I think that history will straighten it out. It's all straightened since now, but this was a subject of a real advertising propaganda. All that's bad, that can be bad, I think, about science. And there was meetings oh, there was a meeting in Germany in the 60s, and it was published in Carlisle Zeitschrift, and somebody wrote me a letter and said, would you like to come and be a chairman of a session? I said, no, I can't come to Germany to be a chairman of a session. The subject I've spent 20 years and have things to say. If you don't think I'm worthy of making a presentation, I wouldn't come. I went to that Bristol meeting in 1960 that Frank and Keller had, and my time got chopped away and chopped away and chopped away until I got left about 5 minutes to talk. And now it was a very difficult period for me, and but I feel quite good about things now.
Where did the support come from eventually?
Well, I think the support, you mean from science or from mm-hmm. people?
Well, either one, yeah. Or both.
Well, I think that there was the approach that I was taking, A, that the properties did not allow this to happen, but this was a deductive thing, and this was probably one of the reasons. One, that chain statistics wouldn't allow this to happen. Then Fleury had one paper in 62, which I think was pretty much ignored by most of these people, that explained why you would form the lamella without having to fold the chains, and why you didn't have to invoke this nucleation theory of Hoffman's to do that. And then I think the real thing that sort of broke it open was neutron scattering. And then there were several papers, starting with George Wignall and people from ICI, who showed that the radius of gyration did not change from that of the melt, and they looked at molecular weight relations. In other words, if you had a regular folded, if a lamella made a regular folded chain, it's a high school algebra to calculate what the radius of gyration would be, and they're nowhere close, I mean, by orders of magnitude. You couldn't explain that. So that, I think, I didn't do it, but I think that, in a sense, that's what turned a lot of people who didn't want to believe, and a lot of people just not in polymers or crystalline polymers, and all aspects, just look at things sort of superficially. And so people were not too much convinced by the kind of experiments that we were done, but I think the neutron scattering was a little more dramatic and more direct. And so I would say, sort of retrospect, that was probably, that started in the 70s. And it became quite clear that things were going to give.
In 72, you wrote a book, Introduction to Macromolecules.
That was quite, that was a different kind of thing, yeah. That was a labor of love for a different reason. I've been concerned, and several of us have been concerned for some time, for the lack of introduction of polymers. I'm not talking about proteins and nucleic acids, but in a non-sexy way, so to speak, into even high school chemistry or undergraduate, certainly an undergraduate. In fact, there's a whole program now, the polymer division, to do this. And it used to bother, it bothers me, still bothers me now. And so one of the questions was, how can you get students at a very young age, seniors in high school, freshmen in college, who are interested in learning, would pick up a book like this, pick up a book and read it, to learn that there were such things as polymers and macromolecules, that they were as interesting as argon or ethane, and they could be treated in the same kind of way. So this promoted it. And it was sort of a labor of love. I really enjoyed doing it.
How was that received?
That was received very well. That's been received very, very well. And I felt, well, it was very interesting. Several publishers I approached wouldn't touch it. I can't remember all the names, but that doesn't matter. But Conrad Springer has a friend on the campus and was visiting one day, and somehow word, and he popped in to see me, and then they were very much interested. It was just a pleasure working with Springer for Log in New York. Now, this has been, I think, well received. I mean, I don't want to brag, but I mean, all the reviews were favorable, very favorable, like a head swell in some ways. And it's been selling on a steady pace. It's not adapted as a textbook, but it goes. And it ran out of the first printing, and I just made some relatively minor changes, additions. I added a section on liquid crystal type polymers in the new work on, fibers that come from that. And a couple of pages, as little I understand, about genetic engineering and DNA. Well, we talked about DNA in the book, so I talked about how they spliced and put it together. And rather than just have them do some more printing, we figured just a little bit more effort. Now that was quite different. That has been very well received by students and by faculty who teach general chemistry courses, introductory courses and things of that sort.
I think you also have a paper in JChemEd which shows how you can relate this or introduce this into physical chemistry.
And there's another, the ACS is putting out a book that is being edited, is not ready to go yet, I don't think, by Tom Lippincott at the Institute of Chemical Education in Madison now. And I have a chapter in that. Just that, it's just a amplification of that JChemEd paper. In fact, there's a lot of it is lifted straight from it. But there is a lot of work now going on this kind of thing, both in physical chemistry and organic chemistry. In fact, as we have a seminar in Gainesville in 2 weeks at the ACS local ACS meeting on this subject, so it's that part. Yeah, about on the paperback, I'm very happy with that and everything.
I come back, some of the notes I have here we've been discussing in terms of, again, these are comments taken from the nomination for the ACS Polymer Award, and I believe we probably covered most of these. Some of Van Okern's work has not been duly appreciated. But none of it has been refuted in any substantial part. And talking about your persisting tenaciously, moved by ephemeral fashions of the moment. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, you can almost figure out who wrote that. But you're a historian, I'll let you figure it out.
Okay. What about your work here then in, 25 years, I guess?
Yeah, well, as I say, we covered a good chunk of it in the sense that here our work has been primarily involved in, almost all on crystallization, but in different aspects. A good chunk of it has been what we just talked about on the properties, the mechanisms, this is addressing this folded chain, regular folded chain business. And also gone over, we're not doing much in the last few years, but in the first 15 or so years out here on contractile fibers, one of the reasons that motivated me to leave, and we did an extensive amount of work on keratins, the more work, collagens, and on muscle fibers, some of which is appreciated and some of which time will tell. And the only thing that we did out of what I would call the general crystallization area is some work on the conformational analysis of polypeptides. Give or take some piece of work here. But that's basically, I use the word crystallization in a very general sense, that we talk about contractility or structure or properties of a fiber. That's a crystalline entity. And so that's, as I say, we did follow through until the last few years where my interests have changed back to the synthetic polymers on the contractile fibers and on the fibrous proteins, and one of the things that I got started on at the Bureau of Standards and did an extensive amount of work on that, and got interested in some of the conformational problems on polypeptides. But we are, in the last few years, and I don't know how what the future holds for us, I've been pretty much on synthetic polymers. And just, I guess you might say, at this stage of my life, I'm tying up loose ends.
What about your graduate students? Are any specific graduate students that stand out?
Well, I don't distinguish really between graduate students and postdocs. I've had some really, I think that the some standout graduate postdoctoral students and graduate students, Wayne Matice, who is now moving to Dow Chair at Akron, had been in LSU for 20 years, 15, 18 years. Is quite outstanding. He came here and worked on polypeptide problems. Jose Fatu, who's in Madrid, the Institute of Rubber and Plastics, came here. He and Kitamura, who was a professor at Kyoto, were my first postdocs. I never can remember which one came first, but they came within a couple of months of each other. Fatu is a major mover in Spanish polymer chemistry, and he's been following pretty much along the lines of the work we did here. Kitamura has really developed in the last 5 or 6 years and gone into solid state NMR, and done some very interesting and very important contributions. And he didn't do that here, but I just like to think that he learned how to think it and work from his work here. Those stand out in terms of people who are in academia. I haven't had a lot. I've had a lot of postdocs. I hadn't thought about this point prior to your coming here, so I have to stop and I'm getting a little tired, so I don't know how my thinking will be. I have a student, Scott Zimmerman, who is a professor at Brigham Young, who is a very bright student. I believe he's in chemistry. I think biochemistry is part of chemistry there. He's in I have a student, Roberto Benson, who's in the material research at the University of Tennessee, just moved from the University of Utah, in material science and not in chemistry. In terms of people in academia, I've had large number of people in industry here and abroad. I have a student in ATO in France, Michelle Glotten, a recent postdoctoral, who's going to be very important to French industry before too long. I have a postdoc named Armand Dekmazian, D-E-K-M-A-Z-I-A-N, who left here about 4 or 5 years ago, heads up a major group at Exxon in New Jersey at the Linden Labs. I had a postdoc in NMR, Rich Komorowski, K-O-M-O-R-O-S-K-I, who went to industry working on NMR and polymers for a while, had a responsible position at Goodrich, and has left or in the process of leaving to do NMR imaging, and he's going to be a professor at the University of Arkansas Medical School. Ricky Allen, who's at 3M. I have a lot of people in industry. I just can't try and keep track of where they all are. They change around a lot. I have a very good student named Gary Stack, who is at the Naval Research Laboratory branch at Orlando. They have a lab there doing concerned with underwater problems, and they've just gotten into polymers, and he's doing very well there. He's one of the better PhDs we put out of this institution. I have a student, Harry Lader, L-A-D-E-R, who's used to be at DuPont and actually postdoc with Bill Krigbaum, is now with the Nordson Corporation in Cleveland or somewhere in Ohio. They do machinery. They make a lot of machinery for polymer processing. That's what he got into. We've gotten heavily into gels, and the fellow who started as I've got a PhD here, Charles Edwards, is what used to be called General Tire. I don't know what they call it, Genco or GenCorp or something like that. They've changed their name. Does that give you more or less?
Yeah.
I don't have 100 students or anything like that. I had a very good student from Turkey named Ertugoz, E-R-G-O-Z. He did some classical work here on crystallization kinetics, very classical, I think. And he's manager of some rubber plant in Turkey, rubber manufacturing plant in Turkey. I don't know the exact, off the top of my head. I don't want to slight anybody, but I think we're...
Is there anything else that is on your list that
I just made some notes from your list, and I just wanted to hope I made clear. I want to this. I think that what is important historically, one of the things that ought to be clear, I think what I might discuss for another moment is this problem, is the scientific problem of this ball the chain thing, which I think is a good time to talk about it.
Okay.
I think I've said, I just want to sort of emphasize in the editing that is an important thing, is I think the issues are pretty well decided now. And it was, from a, since this is a, sort of a, my history, it was a very, personally, a very difficult, harassing sort of situation for a long time. That the problem, it persisted for 20-some years, is not, it's not the question. The question is that there was, for a long time, a rather difficult personal time for me to keep working. And I do appreciate, I don't think I should mention names, but several companies that kept me on as a consultant, picked me up as a consultant, kept me on, had enough, thought I could help them, despite the fact that I think I would say, frankly, in the early 60s, that our work on crystalline polymers was probably held in disrepute. I mean, I think that would be a fair statement to say. And I think my book came out at that time, and it got the, if you just somebody go look at it, and I feel quite good about it now in terms of saying, I'm not bragging, but I get introduced as the author of the book, and everybody tells me how much they read it and how much they want the new edition. But I do think this is, for historians, it was a, looking at this in a little more, you know, can look at it from all points of view, not just from mine. It was a very difficult period. I think it was a very bad period for science, because it was a good lesson, I think, of how controversies in science should not be settled. They should not be settled by political innuendos, by keeping people off of programs, by, I don't want to go through all the harassment at the Bureau of Standards. That's not the way. They just get the solutions just get delayed. And I think this is a point I would really like to make, that for you look, as you folks look at these things over the different aspects, that there's very standard sort of ways that scientific controversies have gotten set for time immemorial. And it doesn't have to get involved in depriving people of things to do and things of that sort. But when we look back at it, perhaps it was a very hard experience, but I think the science is straight, and that's what's important. So, and I was doing other things also, so I kept myself from going completely crazy. So you may have some things to ask me. I think that this is basically, I check over my notes I made from your letter. But if I made sense to you, this is basically what I wanted to.
No, it's fine, and I guess what we'll do is close at that point. Then, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you for coming down. You might want to edit, put this in some other place, but I think that this, I think, is a very classic example of how two scientific gentlemen can have a major in the same institution, in the same department, can have a major, major disagreement and still go out to lunch and enjoy each other's company and still have the problem settled in the proper way. And what I'm talking about, anybody who's familiar with the period of 1949-50-51, is the intramolecular excluded volume effect, where Fleury had one position and Debye had the absolute 180-degree opposed position. And you could have seminars where they would argue and their students would argue and discuss these things. It might have got hot and heavy, but nothing personal, nothing vitriolic. And I've seen many a time when Debye and Fleury would argue in the morning and go out to, and I'd be there when they'd go off to lunch together. And it got settled, and they had tremendous admiration for each other's intellectual and personally, and the problem got resolved. Which way it got is not important, but that's the way I think things. And this is something I learned way back in 1950, and I think that's the way gentlemen and scientists settle their things. They had very deep-seated disagreements on whether the excluded volume effect went asymptotically with molecular weight, it continued indefinitely with molecular weight, and it had very significant, it wasn't an academic, it was more than an egotistical argument, it had many practical effects in how you interpreted almost all solution properties of polymers. And it took a few years to get straightened out, but it got straightened out. So I thought you might want to put that in, but I think that's, to me, a classical way.
opportunity to do a postdoc with Paul Florey, and led to a long association, both professional and personal association, between Leo Mendelberg and Paul Florey. Really, I think Leo could talk on two different kinds of topics at a symposium such as this one. I'll come to the topic he's actually going to talk on in a moment, but one might have imagined a situation where he could have spoken on the obligation and the role of those of us who know that polymers are important and fascinating to get that idea across as much as we can to as many people as we can. He has done this by a very popular book, An Introduction to Macromolecules, that is written not for the practitioner in the art of polymers, but to get people to know very little about polymers to a position where they can better appreciate what polymers are. He certainly has done it in regard to training to the students, and also the point of view of trying to train existing faculty in chemistry departments. Maybe I should have put that a little bit differently. The point of view here is that polymers are a relatively new type of molecule, new in terms of the history of chemistry. And many of the faculty in chemistry departments who might be easily persuaded that chemists should pay more attention to polymers in their teaching just simply don't have the training with which to do that. Both Paul Florey and Leo Mendelberg recognize that as a very important activity for those of us who know that polymers are both important and fascinating types of molecules. But today, instead, he's going to teach us talk on another topic that's also important. It's one that is almost synonymous with the name Leo Mendelberg. Anybody who's interested in crystalline polymers certainly is aware that Leo Mendelberg has worked in the field. Some of them perhaps to a little bit of discomfort if they happen to have some ideas about crystalline polymers, which are a rather controversial type of polymer, that run into trouble when they must confront the experiments that Leo has done. Anybody who wants to explain what crystalline polymers are and how they behave must confront the experimental evidence. And Leo is the ultimate person in giving us that experimental evidence. Leo Mendelberg, R.O.L.O.C. and professor at Florida State University, and crystalline polymers.
Thank you. After that introduction, I ought to just say it's time to go home. I don't think I can do any better than that. Am I audible? Thank you. Very fine introduction, Wayne. And I'd like to thank the organizing committee and the chairman of this symposium for the very distinct privilege of inviting me to participate. Paul Florey had a very important and significant influence in my life, both as a teacher and a friend over many, many years. And it is indeed a privilege and an honor to be able to talk at this symposium on a today. In addition, he introduced me to the subject of the talk this afternoon, and he made, in his own way, some of the very basic contributions to the field. And I think that as a, for two purposes, first to serve as a background as to what I want to talk about, what I will be talking about this afternoon, and the fact that if we are historians, we might say that the revisionists are already among us, I thought it might be useful to briefly review, or just really highlight, some of his contributions to the field, not necessarily in chronological order, but in some sort of logical order, as it appears to me. So if I could have the first slide, please. Okay, we start back in 1949, and I think 1955, the statistical thermodynamics of copolymer melting. The first paper was actually done when Paul was on the staff here at Goodyear in Akron, And this is a paper which establishes the first time that the fusion of polymers, the melting crystallization process, is a first order transition and shows that it can be treated almost in a classical manner. And they have to apply this to the melting of electrolyte fractions, to polymer diluent mixtures, and to copolymers. They also pointed out this 1949 paper, which I strongly recommend for those interested in this field to read, that the crystalline, non-crystalline boundary, or the crystalline amorphous boundary, as it was known then, could not be sharp. And this was, and also introduced the concept of the importance of the interfacial free energy and its uniqueness in chain molecules. And this was back in 1949. Going down a little road and trying to move along, there was a series of papers at Cornell on crystallization kinetics and sphere-like growth rates. And here is shown that the crystallization kinetics of chain molecules, essentially classical in behavior in the sense that they follow the Brahmi kinetics. He was the first to show, and I think it's very important, that polymer crystallization was a nucleation control process. And I might point out, in those days, he didn't know, or we didn't know about lamella or folded chains. But from a very general observation, you can conclude that we had a nucleation control process. With A.D. McIntyre, not our Don McIntyre, but Dick McIntyre, they studied the rate formation of sphere-like growth, and also showed that that was also a nucleation control process. It's an experiment that I can say has probably been repeated on every crystalline polymer that has since been made. This was on some aliphatic polyesters, always with the same result, very strong temperature coefficients, indicative of nucleation control. Getting a little closer to modern times, in 1963, with Jackson and late Bob Chang, he pointed out by some rather simple density measurements accomplished by centrifugation that the so-called single crystals that were appearing then were not completely crystalline, and about 20% of the material in the system was indeed some type of disordered overlayer. This work, to be conservative, was severely criticized on both theoretical and experimental grounds. And it turned out that it's a very central and fundamental set of experiments which has stood the test of time some 27 years later and amply confirmed by a variety of other experimental techniques. And it was important, and this was the first lesson right there in that paper, that solution crystals, no matter how pretty they look, are not completely crystalline. And this must be taken cognizance of when you try to understand their properties. We have next the formation of the lamellar crystallites and the structure of the interface, grouping them together. In 1962, Paul Fleury set forth the fundamental reason that one formed lamellar crystallites, namely the problem or the need to dissipate the flux of chains that emanated from a crystal face and tried to get into the disordered liquid-like or isotropic region. This required some type of folding and the formation of lamella. He also pointed out, well, the corollary, he pointed out that you did not have to manipulate the work with monomeric nucleation theory to explain the fact that one has lamellar crystallites. It was a consequence of the conformational differences in the crystal state and in the isotropic or liquid-like state. In a rather significant paper in 1984 with Jung and Hill, he worked out the structure of this interface, and this is really a tour de force, and it cleaned without worrying about the details, and as I go along later on in my talk, we'll talk about some of the results. The things they pointed out that were important, that one has to take into account the bending energy, or the free energy that it takes to make a bend or a fold, and also be concerned with what would call the tilt angle. And lots of papers have been coming along in the last few years. And last night, as I was coming into Cleveland thinking about some of these things, I sort of had a deja vu. That's the right way to pronounce. My French isn't very good. There are a lot of papers, Opie, and I would predict that every 2 or 3 months there'll be either the Journal of Chemical Physics or Macromolecules, a paper dealing with the structure of the interface. And the recollection is 20, 25 years ago with the problem of the intramolecular excluded volume. And after a while, I think there still is, but for a while there, every month in the Journal of Chemical Physics, there was at least one paper considering from some point of view the problem of the intramolecular excluded volume. But this paper is a particularly vital paper, and it points out, using a lattice technique, the nature of the interfacial structure, and we'll talk about that a little more later. On the last item on this slide, the melting temperature molecular weight relation. This was work that was done with Marie. And here they looked at the molecular weight, the melting temperature, as it depended on molecular weight for uniform chain lengths. And they could account for the melting temperature and the enthalpy of fusion for normal hydrocarbons up to C100, which was all that was available in 1963, and allowed for a very good extrapolation to the infinite, to the melting temperature of the infinite chain. Now, recently, it's last year or two, there has been synthesized in Keller's laboratory and in Beckman's laboratory independently normal alkanes up to C390. Now, it's going to be very interesting, and it's going to allow for a further test of the Floyd-Reef theory. When we have available thermodynamically significant melting temperatures, as well as enthalpies of fusion, to see how good the theory is when we now have data for much higher normal hydrocarbons, or indeed whether it's going to be any type of revision. Knowing time, I hope it won't be too long, we'll be able to answer that question. And we finish up. I guess I went reverse. Here we are. Then we have the period of 1956-1957, the consideration of the elastic mechanisms of fibrous macromolecules, proteins, and polymers, and the influence of the crystallization melting process on the pores length temperature relation for the thermoelastic properties. From this, a formal mechanism for contractility and tension development can be developed, and its applicability of these ideas to biofunctioning biological systems still remains to be explored. In the same line, for inert systems with Holt and with Spur, was able to demonstrate coexistence curves with suspected natural rubber and collagen. In the 70s and 1981, with the advent of Newton Sands and small angle neutron scattering, with Do Yoon, was able to analyze the small angle neutron scattering patterns of polyethylene and polypropylene, both crystallized in bulk from dilute solution, and from that deduce the chain structure and what we would call the molecular morphology. And the problem of the adjacent reentry, was addressed directly by their analysis, and they concluded that this could not be a very significant effect. And the last item, which is not too well recognized, was his contribution to the study of mechanical properties of crystal polymers. There's a paper with Yoon in Nature, which is concerned with the problem of molecular morphology in general. But there is a short section in this paper which points out the importance of the non-crystalline regions to large deformation, that is, to force length curves, stress strain curves. And in this short section, the important role of partial melting recrystallization is postulated and argued very strongly. This latter point was confirmed about 2 years ago in a set of elegant experiments by George Whitnell and Wendy Wu. Overstay my time, I think some of the results from our laboratory will be consistent with this postulate. So what I've tried to outline here very briefly, and not completely, and certainly not with complete justice, are some of the rather fundamental contributions to the field of crystal polymers and flexible chains that we have as a result of this work, and the fact that they have indeed stood the test of time, some for a long number of years. Some, I think, as we recognize, were controversial at the time, but as I mentioned, they have withstood the test of time, namely experiment and further theoretical analysis, and they serve really as the basic foundation for this whole subject. Now, although we have this basic foundation, we still have some problems, and we have the problems if we're concerned in some detail about properties, particularly macroscopic properties of crystalline polymers, will depend on molecular structure. And the reason we have the problems is because answering this question involves understanding in some detail some of the morphological features, how they are controlled, and how they indeed affect the properties. And this is what I would really, this is what I'd like to spend the rest of my time discussing in a succinct way, the relation between structure and properties. And that's like saying we love mommy and apple pie. And to be more specific, we should first recognize that there are two elements of structure that we have to be concerned with. One is the element of molecular structure, namely the chain structure, molecular constitution, things like molecular weight, structural regularity, and the other are the structural factors that determine the properties of the crystalline state. And the plan that we try and follow, or the strategy that we'll be using, is to try and identify the structural factors that describe and determine the crystalline state, to see how these are affected by molecular constitution and crystallization conditions, and then see how they can be isolated, how the structural properties of these can be isolated, properties, and the properties that I'd like to focus on here along will be this afternoon, mechanical properties. Now we start with the concept that we have lamellar-like crystallites, and we'll see their limitations. And then the first question to address is what are, or what appear to be, the independent structural variables which govern the properties of semi-crystalline polymers. And I think we have identified some of them. There very well may be more. And let me go on the next slide when we have prepared. I can't tell from here. Is this in focus? Okay. Well, we have the obvious level of crystallinity, which some years ago was considered to be a proper concept, which I think is now shown, and now it's shown to be a rather quantitative concept. We have, what I've listed, I think correctly, but get the idea, of course, the residual amorphous structure. It's a structural feature that's been pretty well ignored. It's important. This is essentially what's left behind by the crystals, and we'll talk some about that in a moment. We have the crystallite thickness, the crystallite thickness distribution, which can be experimentally determined by a variety of methods and depending on the polymer that you're studying. We have the interface, the interface, or the interface, or the interfacial structure, what the structure is, and the relative amount, that is the extent in the particular system. We also have the question of the variable of the internal structure. Are we seeing double here? Let me focus it better. Well, let me focus it better. There we go. Let me go. Good. Well, I'm going to go down here. Pardon? Let me go down here. Well, if you can focus it. Okay, you want to put the slides? I don't know why the focus is changing. Chain axes and the basal plane of the lamellic crystallites. And we also have the super question of the supramolecular structure, which is the
way in which the crystallites are organized relative to one another or not organized. The organized form, most popular ones, of course, the formation of spherulites, that would be a form of a supermolecular structure. So these are a set of independent structural variables which, as a consequence of experience, play an important role in the determination of many properties. Now, before examining how molecular structure affects these things, we will, I think it's informative to see how a polymer crystallizes in a very formal way. So, Wade, if you're mine, can I have the next one, please? No, you're going the wrong way. Nice. So here we have a crystallization kinetics isotherms. We have a vertical axis, 1 minus lambda, which is the extension of the transformation, against the log of time on an arbitrary axis. This is 1 decade. And what we've done is taken a set of fractions of linear polyethylene at a given temperature, 127 degrees, and put them all, taking their different time scales, and since they all start with the same shape, push them together so they all form one isotherm, all starting the same way. The solid line is the classical monomeric Raman type crystallization kinetics, running from zero, no transformation, to one, complete transformation. And we run approximately from 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th. And there are several important features here. One is that they all start the same way. So all irrespective of the molecular weight, these are fractions, crystallization kinetics always starts the same way, following a Brahmi. It starts to deviate from the Brahmi at different levels of crystallinity, depending on the molecular weight. The lower the molecular weight, the higher up you go. The high molecular weight, you start deviating much lower. And the other point is, when after they deviate, we're on a log time scale, they are essentially flat. It takes a long time scale, to get this 10 to the 6th molecular weight to increase its crystallinity very substantially, or very significantly, rather. So molecular weight has sort of two effects. And in a practical sense, it tells us that we have a limit on the level of crystallinity that we can attain. In this case, it's running roughly, we'll see the numbers in the next slide in a moment much better, for about 80% to 30%. And it also tells us there must be something, because you can wait, you know, for long times here and nothing is happening. The fact that it's leveling off is not a time factor. It tells us there must be some structures in this residual non-crystalline region, some topology, some topological features, which essentially encourage the crystallization process. This is an experimental fact, got nothing to do with the arguments of whether you have reptation or segmental relaxation, or what's happening mechanistically. Just nothing is happening as you get far enough along in time, and we essentially stop the crystallization process dead. Now, if we can have the next slide, you can see the results of this a little clearer, perhaps a little cleaner. This is the linear polyethylene. And we have the degree of crystallinity, or the extent of the transformation, on the density scale against the log of the molecular weight. And there's nothing very interesting happens. It stays about 80-90% until you get to 10 to the 5th, and then it starts dropping down, and it drops down to about 40%, which is what we saw before. What will happen if we get higher? I don't know. Now, this isn't something that's unique to polyethylene, although polyethylene is going to be the major vehicle that we'll be looking at things this afternoon. The next slide, I believe, shows it for several different polymers, for polyethylene and polyethylene oxide, perhaps coincidentally, fall on essentially the same line, with identical molecular weight fractions, getting down to about 30%, 30, 40% crystallinity at the high molecular weight. This is an aromatic polysilicon polymer that McGill has been studying, and it seems to show the same trends. And this is for trans polyisoprene, some data in the literature. This is all that we have. So that the extent of crystallinity, and these are waiting long times, these are not consequences of time effects. The kinetics of time have all been taken care of. So this is a rather large effect. And it can't be attributed to Andrews, to Basilia, to things like that, because you see they're going in the opposite direction. We're decreasing
the concentration of N groups as we increase the molecular weight. So if we look at the polyethylene, polyethylene oxide, these are after crystallization temperatures, up to about 10 to the fifth, it stays pretty high level, and then it starts to drop rather drastically. The next slide, thank you, Wayne, shows that we bring the same samples, the same kind of experiment, down to room temperature, looking at density, but it's the same result. A density of 1 is 100% crystallinity. If we crystallize it, and we see the same sort of effects, depending on how you crystallize now, we can change the level of the crystallinity, or the level of density, but not particularly the trend with molecular weight. And if we went to branch systems or copolymers, we reduce the level of crystallinity even further. So that from the point of view of wanting to examine how this structural factor, the level of crystallinity, influences properties, we have a pretty large command in the values of the level of crystallinity that we want to look at. We can go from 90% down to zero if we go over to a copolymer and we use the proper control. The next one of the variables I want to look at would be the crystallite structure. This is an important variable. It's always lamella, but there are some major exceptions. And I like to talk about the crystallite structure, the lamella structure in terms of transmission intersection electron microscopy done with Dr. Bogmartin at Mainz over the last few years. And before we try to look at the set of micrographs, we can say that the lamella or the crystallites become more curved with increasing molecular weight and increasing undercooling or lower crystallization temperature. They also, as I was trying to hopefully see, become segmented. In other words, they do not stay completely nice and clear. There are lines through them indicating some break. And their lateral dimensions decrease. Now we can vary the mode of crystallization, and you see essentially the same thing except for a molecular weight shift. So on the next slide, we have a series of molecular weight fractions rapidly crystallized. And you can see for the low molecular weights, here we are in 10,000, nice, flat, very long lamella. Everything's still lamella. Here, this is about 10 to the fifth, and it's starting to be curved. This is 200, so this is about 10 to the something. This is about 100,000, 200,000, very short lamella, highly curved. Incidentally, the technique, the staining technique, and the photographic reproduction is that the light regions are the crystallites, the dark regions are the stain-absorbing regions. The crystallites don't exist in result of stain. And then we have this up to 10 to the 6th, but they're so short and so highly broken up that I cannot be able to get a decent slide made to make the point. But you can, as you look closely, you can see that there are lines of dark inside the lamella, and so we call segmented, and we'll see more than that when we get to the copolymers. So although we have lamella, and there's no argument, and you can talk about lamella and folder chains, the structure of the lamella, their breadth, their curvature, vary quite a bit depending on the molecular weight. You'll see exactly the same thing if you went to a isothermal kind of crystallization temperature, except everything is shifted with molecular weight. Now, if we go to copolymers, a set of copolymers that we want to look at, I'm going to be looking at, are hydrogenated polybutadienes, which are essentially close to randomly distributed ethyl groups. Other copolymers are about to behave in exactly the same way that I have in this one.
isolated. And on the other hand, if you stop and think about a random copolymer having two mole percent methine carbons, and the ethyl groups are not going into the crystal lattice, it's rather unexpected to say at least to see the global level amount. If we go to the next copolymer, which I believe is 3.2%, you still see the lamellae. They're similar to what we saw at one of the higher molecular weights, but they're getting shorter and they're getting mature, but again in the realm of lamellae. The next slide, the last one in this series, is for 4.5% methine carbons. And the electron microscopists sort of throw this away. It's not interesting, but it is. This sample is about 15% crystalline. And you can see little places. So the lamellae have become degraded, if you wish. That's the right word, dissipated. But there are, you can still pick up the crystalline regions. So the point to be made here is one has, as they command, the ability to go from the kind of type of crystallized structure, from very long, flat, broad lamellae, to systems that aren't even lamella, and every stop in between. So this is the variable of the property that we have in control. Crystallized structure, still staying within the framework of the lamellae. Now, one brief word, because I think it's going to come important for time, is the tilt angle that I mentioned, namely, again, the angle between the basal plane of the lamellae and the chain axis of the chain of the polymer, of the chain. Now, by analyzing in more detail some of the electron micrographs, and also for other people have done by X-ray diffraction, one finds that for the polyethylene case, which unfortunately is the only case that's been studied in any detail, the chain axes are not normal to the broad face of the lamellae. At high crystallization temperatures or low undercoolings, the angle is close to zero, it's 19 degrees. But if you go to rapid crystallization temperatures, the angle is the order of 40 degrees. And we'll see in a few moments why this is an important fact. It's also must be important, and I think it has a clue to us, which we haven't been able to fathom yet, as to something in terms of the details, the less phenomenological aspects of the crystallization mechanism. But we only know this for the polyethylene at the present time. Now, another variable that was important was the interface, or the interphase, or the interfacial structure. By consideration of properties and by the fluorine analysis and others of a small angle neutron scattering, one rules out the idea of having any type of regular folded interfacial structure. The question has really come through now is how much adjacent reentry is there in the bulk crystallized system which we're focusing in today. And the lamellar structure, as I mentioned, comes about from the space filling problem, the problem of dissipating the flux of change coming out of the broad phase of lamellae. Now, in the interphase calculation of Flory, Hume, and Dill that I mentioned early on, for polyethylene, they conclude that there's very little adjacent reentry, that is the order of about 15%. What you conclude in this type of calculation, or what you will conclude, will depend very crucially on the free energy for making a bend and on the tilt angle. For example, if you had a 45 degree tilt in polyethylene, depending on, because of its crystal structure and because of its conformational properties, you have no problem at all with dissipating the flux that comes out of the basal plane. You can envisage some other type of chain where the bending energies are so favorable, because maybe Gauss is highly favored, that you might change that number. But so the calculations are only going to be physically meaningful when you can put rational numbers, reasonable numbers in for the tilt angle and for the bending energy, bending free energy. Now, there have already been several calculations which display perhaps the mathematical prowess of the authors, but neglect the tilt angle, more particularly the bending free energy. And the point is, if you stop to think about the problem and how do you dissipate the flux, if it isn't going to cost you anything to make a fold, that's what you're going to do in great confusion to solve your problem. And if you go straight up, then you have a more serious problem than you have if you have a tilt. So it's not surprising that if you neglect the bending energy, you're going to come up with anywhere from 50 to 75% of adjacent reentry. That's, I think, you could argue this out without having to do too much mathematics, because it doesn't cost you anything to do that. So the real problem is to analyze for cases besides polyethylene the balance between having to dissipate the flux and the energy it costs you to figure out how you're going to do it, or calculate how you're going to do it. Now, the other part of the interfacial problem is the how thick is the interface, what is the relative amount? Now, there are various ways of trying to get at the relative thickness or the relative amount of the interface. If you know the thickness of your crystallite, then you can calculate the thickness of the interface. The method that we've been using is a rough analysis of the Raman internal load method. You get pretty much similar results if you use broadline proton NMR, as been done by Kitamura some years ago, and several other methods will show you that there is a significant interface. Recent carbon 13 analysis shows a resonance that can reasonably be attributed to the interface, and careful analysis of small angle scattering indicates that two-phase analysis does not work, and you have to bring in some 10 to 15 angstrom thick interface. But to be quantitative, we found this Raman method rather useful, at least consistent. It may not be, the numbers may not be precise, but things scale, and that's the right, in a way that's very informative. And if I can have the next slide, the table for the linear polyethylenes, and alpha B is our notation for the fraction of the material phase as opposed to which is in the crystal or which is in the liquid like. And for low molecular weights, the order of less than 300,000, it's even 0 to 5%. The experimental error is relatively large. When you go to higher molecular weights, then you're in the order of 10%, and the mode of crystallization doesn't seem to be important. I would like, when we get to talking about properties, if you have been putting a lot of numbers to you, if you try to remember this column here, that low molecular weights, that is 200,000 less, not so low, you don't get much of an interfacial contribution. When you start getting the high molecular weights, you do. And the next slide carries the same kind of argument over to copolymers. These are random type ethylene copolymers. And we code them hydrogenated polybutadiene, ethylene butene, ethylene octene, ethylene bioacetate. These are all fractions of branched polyethylenes and ethylene propylene. And I say the diazo and propyl because this was actually work that was done by Richardson. The polymers were made by Richardson Jackson back in 1963. And Professor Fleury gave me some about 1970, and Rachel Sabin. They stayed nice and stable. And when we wanted to look at some systems, these are very high molecular weight, so they have a higher value of alpha B, but these are multi-millions. Than the more conventional ones, they're scattered. But as we increase the mole percent branches for the co-unit, then we go from our 5% that we had for a linear polymer all the way up to the order of 20% interfacial content for the random type copolymers, which again I would like you to remember because I think it would play important. But try and demonstrate that this plays an important part contribution to the certain properties. Now, the next to last, I think the third from last property that's important, structure that's important, is the crystallite thickness. And here we have to be concerned about several things: how we crystallize, the molecular weight, and how long we crystallize. I'm going to take two extremes. I'm going to crystallize very rapidly and look at the crystallite thickness distribution by Raman, LAM. I can have the next slide, please, Wayne. Here we have, this is the rapid crystallization. And we have, these are quenching temperatures, not crystallization temperatures, but they're reproducible for films of the same thickness. We run from 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 4th. So for any of these are half widths, these are widths rather of the distribution at half heights. For crystallized size distributions of polymers, these are fairly narrow distributions. And there is no molecular weight effect. If you crystallize rapidly, there is a slight effect of the quenching temperature. and you can therefore prepare and narrow distribute samples in the order between 201 and 100 angstroms. Now, if you want thicker crystals, then you certainly can make thicker crystals by atmospheric crystallization up to several thousand angstroms. You have to do this isothermally at high temperature crystallization. And then you have to, turns out, you have to pay a price. The price is a very broad molecular weight distribution, because as the system is crystallizing over the long times that are involved, you get a thickening effect, which is well documented now. And so one can have, and we'll see examples of large thicknesses, in some cases up to several thousand angstroms, but these are always in systems with very broad size distributions, because they have to be done isothermally. Now, if we get away from the loop, from the linear polymers, we go to the branched copolymers, they can range in thickness from 40 angstroms to 100 angstroms, depending primarily on how we crystallize. Now, the important part of the structure that we can't say very much about is the residual liquid-like structure, which would be the isotropic structure between the lamella, that would be the structure between the lamella that's not in the interface. And this can comprise, as we've seen from our level of crystallinity, a significant portion of our system. If I can have the next slide, please. Okay, this is an artist's rendition. It takes a few moments to get used to it. What might be happening? And what we have is one lamella crystalline and a chain, some of them coming back in, and that's not a concern for this particular slide. We're concerned with those that are coming out and going to the next crystallite, and those that are coming. There, this region between here and here is essentially isotropic, theoretically, and unfortunately so far, experimentally. But one can envisage, with a little imagination, a large number of different ways that the chains can be isotropic. We can have a loop that comes back and does nothing. We can have a loop that's coming back here and hooking on with connecting two lamellae. We can have chains that are just going across. We can have chains that are not interlocking or knotting and going from here. The problem is that these will probably be contributing to certain properties in different ways, and experimentally so far, because all these kind of structures that we've been able to think of are isotropic, it's difficult to devise an experiment to distinguish one experiment to the other, and so we are fortunately or unfortunately at the moment in the hands of the theorists to give us some guidance as to what might be reasonable kinds of structures to expect, because there are reasons to believe that for the same levels of crystallinity, certain properties, particularly mechanical ones, can be quite different, and we think it's probably involved in what's between these lamellae. So this is a problem for the future, and one that we don't have much to contribute except the great concern for. The last of the independent structural variables is probably the one that's been extraordinarily popular with people, namely the supramolecular structure. That is, how are the crystallites organized in space, and what effects then, as we'll see, do they have or don't have on properties? Now, there are various ways of studying supramolecular structure. The one we chose as the sort of semi-routine one is small angle light scattering using the HB mode technique that was pioneered by Stein and by Fawai. And if you take polyethylene and or polyethylene oxide, which are the two polymers we studied intensively, if I could have the next slide, shows that in the small angle light scattering patterns, you can see five different types of patterns. You see the one on the upper left, marked A, is a standard cloverleaf with no intensity in the center. That's the classical cerulite pattern. And you can have cloverleafs with sort of degraded things. We'll talk about what they mean in a moment. This one has azimuthal scattering. You can look carefully. And this is a two-dimensional and circularly symmetric. Theoretically, Stein and Kawhi and others have related these patterns to morphological or supramolecular structures, which I've summarized on the next slide, in a notation system which isn't so good, but I'll have to ask you to remember for a few moments. On the left here, we have the five patterns that we've actually observed. And these are the type of supermolecular structures, A, B, and C. I've just serialized, which are less well-ordered or degrading as you look at A, B, C. D are thin rods or rod-like aggregates. G is a rod comparable, the breadth comparable to length, which essentially makes them sheet-like. And H is randomly oriented lamellae. These two, there should be a bracket here, come from the same H angular dependence. That's why we have a bad notation. So that if you see no scattering, then you don't know what you have unless you go ahead and do some electron microscopy. We'll be talking about these and all, if there's ever a question, we settle it by electron microscopy. And I might say before, those who aren't happy with, there are people sometimes who aren't happy with small angle light scattering. All the structures and situations where we have seen a particular structure, thin section, electron microscopy has confirmed that structure, so the small angle light scattering is a rather good technique. Now what you can do is now look at your molecular weight range that you have at your command, your crystallization conditions, and just see what type of supermolecular structure you get under particular conditions. So let's remember the letters A, B, C, D, G, H from this column here, okay? And the next slide, please, thank you, is what we call a morphological map. This is the linear polyethylene. And this is the isothermal crystallization region. And you see various, you see interesting thing, which we did these first up there, at a very high molecular weight. You see no superstructure. And you see very poor spherulites. You see a lot of these sheet and rod-like structures. And the main thing is, depending on the molecular weight and the crystallization conditions, you can see a lot of different structures. As a matter of fact, even for fairly low molecular weights, a little bit over 100,000, rapidly crystallized, you don't see any superstructure. That's interesting. From a pragmatic, practical sense, you can pick a molecular weight, let's say here, and by changing the crystallization conditions for the same molecular weight, you can go through a whole myriad of supermolecular structures, and then you could ask yourself, by appropriate experiment, what effect does the supermolecular structure have on a given property? It also turns out, quite fortuitously, that in some of these situations, the level of crystallinity that you get doesn't change very much, so that sort of nasty variable is not present with you, and that was just fortuitous. So then we can utilize this. Now you can do the same sort of thing with branch polymers and copolymers, except of course you have another variable worrying about the extent of branching, but and that's been worked out. So these morphological maps allow us to address the question, and those who've been following properties of polymers know that there's been a great focus all the time on spherulites, and of course you can see spherulites. The point I want to make, you don't always see spherulites. So now we can turn to the last 7 or 8 minutes, 10 minutes that I have. To the properties. Now, admittedly, I spent a disproportionate amount of my time talking about the structure. But this was you had to know something about the structure and something about how you could control the structure by varying molecular weight, change structure, and crystallization conditions to answer what does a particular property depend on, or what's controlling a particular property. Excuse me. Now, I'll just in passing say that it turns out that a large number of properties, if we can have the next slide, please, Wayne, depends on nothing more than the level of crystallinity. So tempered sometimes by a contribution from the interfacial free energy or the structure of the interface. There are probably several more that can be added on. Mostly now I'd like to address this time the data, this approach, the strategy we have, to the problem of mechanical properties and to two types of mechanical properties. One is the low-frequency dynamic mechanical properties, and the other is the large deformation force length measurements. In the dynamic mechanical measurements, in most crystalline polymers, and particularly polyethylene, there are a series of transitions energy loss peaks, which have been given names, and the molecular basis for what's causing them in some cases have been some confusion and some controversy. In the polyethylene, we have the alpha, beta, not talking about the melting transition, the alpha, beta, and the gamma transition. We are presently working on the gamma transition, so I will pass the discussion on that. The alpha transition, these are low frequency Guyot Vibron experiments, has been pretty well thought about, involved motions within the crystalline region, and it was sort of guessed at it, dependent on the thickness of the crystallites, plus some other things. But now you can, like now the next slide, let me go through these quickly. If we look at the temperature of the alpha transition, this is Bolivia polyethylene, and varying our superstructure, and plotting the data against the crystallite thickness, one finds quite quickly that the temperature of the alpha transition depends only on the crystallite thickness, and the important point in this set of experiments is that the supermolecular structure has nothing, does contributes nothing. And I might say, because I might forget before I end, the important point is that the superstructure does not really determine any property study, except obviously the term optical properties of depth structures that can scatter light. But none of the mechanical properties that we've studied does the superstructure show any effects on at all. The next slide, or the next section that I'd like to talk about, if we hold the slide, is the beta transition in the polyethylenes, which occurs between the gamma and the alpha. And there's been somewhat of a controversy for a long time, and somewhat of an enigma. It's very intense transition in the branch polyethylenes, that's accepted, the copolymers. And there's always been an argument, discussion as to whether it exists in the linear polyethylenes. There have been group papers by very respected investigators that said, yes, there is a transition on the linear polyethylene. And then a group that said, no, there isn't. And all very nice and respectable data. It's also been argued that the beta transition and primarily the branch and sometimes the linear is the glass temperature. That can be ruled out by proton decoupled NMR because you can measure relaxation times right through, get spectra rather, right through the beta transition. If you make the postulate, and we didn't just pull this out of the air, this was a consequence of what we could see, and we found, for example, that if you worked with high molecular weight polyethylenes, you did indeed see the beta transition in the dynamic mechanical experiment, while in the low molecular weight polyethylene, you didn't. And that explained at least the experimental discrepancy without much problem. And also pointed out that perhaps what is contributing to the beta transition is the interfacial contact. And if you make that assumption, you start to make this thing, you make this table, and this table then tells you when you do, or the situations one has seen and not seen the beta transition, and how it relates to the measured interfacial contents. And then I think we conclude that we have an interfacial content on our scale of the order of 10% or greater, one sees a beta transition. And if it's less than 10%, one doesn't see the beta transition. And with this assumption or supposition, one that's enabled to unify something that's been causing people working in this field lots of concern for a long time. It's been this argument of the importance of mechanical properties of the beta transition. That's also in the last few years by Yoon and Wendorf and applied to explaining some puzzling factors in the dielectric relaxation of polyvinylidene chloride. It explains the transition that shows up in copolymers of polyoxymethylene with polyoxyethylene. It shows up in randomly chlorinated polyethylene as against the block chlorinated polyethylene. And presumably, if one works hard enough, one ought to be able to see this in all crystalline polymers and certainly all crystalline copolymers. Now, if I have 5 more minutes, do I have 5 or 6 more minutes? Okay. I would like to proceed to something new, different. And something different for us, namely looking at the large deformation mechanical properties, force length relations, and particularly ultimate properties. Now, this is obviously a complex kind of property that's been widely studied for a long time, and what we like to do is apply our strategy of trying to isolate the variables to this. And what I would like to focus on, don't have time, you can apply the strategy, there will be a paper appearing in the next few months in the Journal of Polymer Science, applying the strategy to all the aspects of the force length curve that we'll see in a moment. All I'll have time for this afternoon is to look at the general character and on the ultimate properties. And if I can have the next slide, please. If you look at almost any review article in any textbook, just a new textbook, I think here for undergraduates just appeared, and this appears, this is a typical stress strain curve for a semi-crystalline polymer. You have your yield, you have this neck region or inhomogeneous deformation, this is called strain hardening, and this is a typical quote-unquote force length curve, and then it's explained, or described rather, by how you deform the spray line. And this, I think, is the standard almost any book or any review article on mechanical properties, any book on physics or physical properties of polymers. The next slide shows you how it's been explained. You start off with these regular folded, well, it's assumed that the deformation of the semi-crystal polymer is identical to the plasticity of the crystals flowing into its substances. That's the underlying assumption that's been through this field for a long time. And then you start now, it's very simple, you start with a regular folded lamellae, you go through slippage and twinning and mark and tight transformations and eventually unfolding the chain, and then you get traction. Well, from what I've been saying the last 15 to 20 minutes, I don't think you'd be surprised that I would be bothered by these last two slides. And these are taken from standard sort of things. One is, we don't always see